Okay. Good, good, good. All right, man. John Gottschall. What's up, buddy? Did I say it right? Gottschall? Gottschall.
You got it.
It's not that difficult. It just looks difficult.
Right.
Right?
Right.
The Fighter in the Cage. So, a professor, rather, in the cage. I got your book right here, and I was fascinated when I heard the concept, and even more fascinated to talk to you about this. You decided to write a book about taking up mixed martial arts and competing.
Yeah.
What caused this bug?
Well, I was working as an English instructor at a small liberal arts college in western Pennsylvania, just outside Pittsburgh. And I was pushing up on middle age. I think I was 38 and a half at the time. And
a
I was
half.
Sort of... Yeah. I don't know why I did that.
It's like five-year-old talk.
I know. I don't know why I did that. Yeah, I have some little kids in my house. Maybe that's why.
Me too.
So I was 38 and a half at the time. And I was sort of, I don't know, career wasn't going that well. I had never made it onto the tenure track, and it looked like I was never going to. So I sort of needed something new in life. And one day I'm at my office hours, and I happen to look out the front window. And there used to be this auto parts store across the street about as far away as, you know, I could hit it with a snowball if I threw it. And this new business had moved in, and it was called Mark Schrader's Academy of Mixed Martial Arts. And I stood there at the window, and I could see the guys in the cage. I could see them dancing, hitting, tackling, rolling. And I had this unexpected emotion, and the emotion was envy. I envied them. They seemed so alive over there, so courageous.
Wow.
I felt like I was sort of rotting away, you know, in my life, in my cubicle. And so I had this sort of funny thought enter my head, and the thought was just a joke at my own expense. And the joke was, wouldn't it be funny if I went across the street and joined them? You know, me, because I have this incredibly civilized job. I've literally never been in a fight before. I'm almost 40. I'm not in very good shape. And then my next thought was, you know, maybe there's a book in that, a sort of nonfiction version of Fight Club. I go across the street. I try to learn how to fight. And along the way, though, I'd be asking these sort of big, deep, eternal questions about the role that violence has played in human life.
Now, there's a difference between violence in terms of, like, people perceive violence as there's being a victim.
Yes.
And that's the violence that I think that everybody has a problem with. What you're engaging in is martial arts. And although violent action happens in martial art, overall, it sounds contradictory.
Yes.
It's not necessarily about violence.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right, and that was my journey. So I go, you know, when I'm first looking at the cage from across the street, I'm looking at it with all the stereotypes that most outsiders have about the sport. And to me, it looks really, really violent. I assume that the guys over there must be have a screw loose. They must be savages. And so I went over there to test a theory, and the theory was, well, you know, there's a darkness at the core of human nature. And mixed martial arts is a perfect metaphor for it, for this violence at the heart of human nature. And then I go over there, and I find that my theory isn't very good. And what's happening over there is rough. It's often bloody and painful. But it's not really quite even violence. I agree, you know, because the emotions behind it are not angry emotions. They're not the emotions of violence or rage. You know, they're the basic competitive emotions.
And it's also, in order to achieve a very high level, you have to achieve something of a Zen state. And that Zen state can be fucked up by emotion. It
yeah.
can be tripped up.
Yeah.
Your training can be tripped up. Your decisions made under the duress of emotion
right.
are the worst decisions.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the things that the instructor, the main instructor, a guy named Mark Schrader, warns us about all the time. Because guys get mad, they get hit, and they get mad. You know, and it's like, don't get mad. It ruins everything. You know, you make bad decisions, you also get tired. Tires
yes.
you out to get mad.
Yeah, you also really get mad when you chase someone to try to get back at them.
Right.
Then you have bad management of energy.
Yeah.
There's so much involved in any sort of martial arts competition, any sort of martial arts training that you don't see unless you engage in it.
Yeah, yeah. It was tremendously valuable to me to do this because at times I thought, well, you know, I'm not the first writer who had the idea to go and get in a fight and write about it. You know, George Plimpton did it. Sam Sheridan did it. I know you've had Sheridan on your mm-hmm. show. He wrote a great book about it.
Yeah.
And a couple other guys. So I wasn't the first to do it. And so as a sort of publicity stunt, that's not really why I did it. I did it because you really don't know anything about it unless you've done it. Mm-hmm. Unless you've gone over there and gotten into the cage and been sort of locked up inside there, they literally lock you up in there half naked, you know, and you're with this other guy, and this other guy's really scary. You know, he's a savage killer. And the only way to get out of that cage is to somehow survive these next few minutes you're going to spend with this guy. So there's an intensity to that thing that you know is there when you watch it from the outside, but it's much different to actually feel it, to feel what's actually happening to you, to feel what it's like to get punched in the face really hard. It was a tremendously educational experience to actually do it.
Did it change the way, like, did you watch martial arts before that, or were you, like, really an outsider when you were, did you watch any UFC matches?
Dude, I've been a fan forever.
You still had, like, some preconceived notions when you saw the cage.
Yeah. I wanted to figure things out about it. Like, why do I watch this? You know, because when I first started watching it, I had a really good excuse. I was in my early 20s. It was about 1995. And I was a committed but basically inept karate student. And the UFC was a tremendous education about what worked in a fight and what absolutely did not. And most of the stuff that I was learning in my karate classes absolutely did not work. You know what I mean? And so I was not new to the UFC. I was not new to cage fighting, but I had a very much of an outsider's perspective on it. And I was confused about what draws people to these kinds of spectacles. What draws people not only to compete in the cage? That's an interesting question. But also, what draws people to watch combat sports or watch other forms of violent spectacle? People who are decent, civilized human beings. Why do we want to watch this stuff?
Now, when you were practicing karate, like, how long did you practice for?
I was maybe 2 years, and I gave it up because of the UFC.
Really?
I gave it up because of the UFC. Yeah,
you missed the boat when Machida came along. Then all of a sudden, people started practicing karate again.
Well, yeah, it's true.
I love Machida.
Absolutely, as long as you're mixing it into a system,
right.
Rather than sticking with Kyokushin karate, which is what I had. And so my school was very purist. Mm. And when I went to my sensei and said, "Hey, you know, sensei." And very carefully, you know, there's authority in these dojos. There's tradition that you question at your peril. And so I went in and said, "Yeah, you know, Sensei Bill, you know, I've been watching these tapes. I watched them on Blockbuster, you know, Blockbuster tapes of these UFC fights. And long story short is guys like us, they're not just losing. They're getting slaughtered. They're getting massacred. You know, they get a couple feeble punches off. They get tackled to the ground, beaten half to death."
Right.
And so I'd say to him, you know, "What do we do? What do you do if you're taken down in a fight?" And he'd be like, and he'd look at me and be, "It's obvious. Just don't get taken down. It's that easy."
Oh.
And right then it hit me that he didn't know anything about fighting. He didn't know how often fights go to the ground. He didn't know that not getting taken down is a martial art.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And he didn't know that if you're not training for that, if you're not drilling, and you're going to get taken down. If you haven't drilled ways to stand back up again, you're going to stay down.
Yeah.
You know? So what I realized then that we were like LARPers, live action role playing. You know what I mean? You know what LARPing is?
No, but I do now.
Well, it's live D&D. You go off into the woods with your friends and you play D&D live. Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
That's awful.
But that's what we were doing basically. We were LARPing as you know, samurai. So after that, I was pretty disillusioned and I gave it up. I would have gone into it earlier, but it took a long time for MMA and BJJ to make it to my neck of the woods. It's been out here in LA and in New York City for a long time, but I've always kind of lived in podunk towns, and it's only not until 2010 or 2011 that I had the option to do this.
Really?
Yeah.
So you had no jiu-jitsu until 2010 or 11? What is this? You're still the same place outside of Pittsburgh?
Yeah.
How far is Pittsburgh from you?
Pittsburgh is about a half hour, but even Pittsburgh had one BJJ school. But that was all. You know, there was a fight club that had gone out of business, an MMA club that had gone out of business. Mm-hmm. They're back now. Henzo Gracie has a school there now, so there is good stuff there now. But
it's very difficult to make money teaching MMA. Very difficult.
Yeah.
You can do much better teaching jiu-jitsu or teaching taekwondo even, or karate.
I think that's right.
You know, I had a similar martial arts upbringing.
Yeah.
I started out in Taekwondo, but dedicated, you know, my entire life to it. And then when I started kickboxing, that was my eye-opening. It was before even grappling.
Yeah.
Grappling was my second eye-opening. My first eye-opening was kickboxing because I realized, and then also just training straight boxing, I realized how terrible my hands were because Taekwondo was so kick-centric.
So feet heavy,
it was just all about kicking. And when guys are only kicking you, there's a lot of things you can get away with that you can't get away with when they're punching you.
Yeah.
And I had this like big enlightenment moment, like, man, I've been wasting my time. Not really, it turned out in the long run, because I learned a lot of things and I developed dexterity that's very unusual. It's flexibility, but anybody could develop flexibility. Is the dexterity is unusual, like the ability to throw kicks in positions and in ways that a lot of other people can't.
Yeah.
And it's just because that's all you do. You're throwing a lot of kicks.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of guys that took that style, like Anderson Silva is one of them, and started out as a Taekwondo guy and then eventually developed all the martial arts skills, takedown defense, wrestling, jiu-jitsu and whatnot. But yeah, when the UFC came around, most people who are on the outside, they'll look at it like I've had so many people say like that it's not martial arts, it's a sport, it's a martial sport, and there's all this silliness attached to it. But what they need to know is that no one knew when I was a kid. No one knew until '93. No one knew.
Yeah.
They didn't know that it was so easy to take you down. And when they did take you down, they would just break your arm. Yeah. Like they'd strangle you in seconds. Yeah. Like no one had any idea how vulnerable they were.
I know.
It
was a shock,
crazy.
Right? Wasn't it a shock?
Total shock.
When I watched, I mean, I remember seeing the first couple of them, and I watched them religiously at first. I'd pause, I'd slow down, I'd rewind, I'd watch the movie, try to etch it, you know, into my memory banks. But I watched with a sinking feeling, like, oh my gosh, this is not at all. It's not at all what I expected.
I started jiu-jitsu almost immediately after discovering it. I found out about it in 94 or 5. I think I found out. It started out in 93, and I think I came out to L.A. in 94, and somewhere in mid-94, I found out about the UFC.
Yeah.
And I didn't see the first one. I saw, like, the second one, and I watched it on video.
That's what I did, too, yeah.
Like a VHS tape of Blockbuster
Video. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. I used to hang out in that section of the video store. I still remember it. I would lurk there dangerously, like guiltily.
LARP.
Well, I mean, lurking there, like you know, when you're in the porno section or something,
right?
Because it was like UFC videos, WWF videos,
Faces of Death,
and Faces of Death was in that section.
They were all lumped in together.
That's what it was with.
Yeah. I remember I was training at the Jet Center, which is a famous kickboxing gym in Van Nuys. It was right before it went under because they had gotten damaged in the earthquake, and then once rain came after the earthquake, they got massive flood damage, and they eventually went under. But before they went under, that was where, when I first moved to California, I started working out. And Benny the Jet Urquidez is like one of the pioneers of not just kickboxing, but incorporating low kicks and fighting against the Thais and the Japanese with their low kicks. And then fighting in like sort of no holds barred tournaments back then.
Yeah.
And Benny had this, you know, and his brother-in-law, I guess, Blinky Rodriguez, is a famous kickboxer as well, would teach classes there. And it was a crazy environment because Blinky had some family tragedy involving gang violence. Mm. So he had a lot of gang members that would train there and work out there. So like you'd have these guys, like I remember this one guy had this really shitty like prison tattoo on his back that said like whatever his gang member was, like La Plata's. And then underneath it said, fuck the rest. Like tattooed big on his back, like a 12-year-old drew it in there. I was like, oh Christ, like this is where I'm working out. Yeah. And, you know, when we take classes with those guys and spar with those guys, which is very disconcerting. Like you didn't want to beat up a gang member and then get shot in the parking lot.
Yeah.
But the place was a buzz about these tapes. Mm-hmm. Like people had found out about them. Mm-hmm. Everybody's like, you see this shit? Mm-hmm. Everybody's like, damn, this motherfucker just grabs people and drags them to the ground, chokes them. And everybody wanted to talk about it. And it was just
stunning. It made no sense.
It not only didn't make any sense. Everybody was like, "What are we doing here? What are we doing with our skill set? Like, is this shit gonna work? Like, what if we run into one of those dudes?" Mm-hmm. And so I went to Carlson Gracie's, which was on
How'd you even know about it?
I found out about the gym from there was a show called I think it was called Extreme Fighting Championships. There was a very small, John Peretti was the matchmaker and he was producing it. Mm-hmm. I think it's called Extreme Combat. Extreme, something extreme. I don't remember.
There was a lot of extreme promotions.
And but they had a montage, like a training montage thing for one of the fighters. Mm-hmm. And he was training at Carlson Gracie's. Mm-hmm. And I knew that Mario Sperry trained there, and he was like one of the big guys at the mm-hmm. time. And Murilo Bustamante was there, and Vitor Belfort was there. Mm-hmm. Before he made his UFC debut, I came in there right when he was making his debut. He had just, I got there when he was about to fight John Hess in Hawaii.
Wow.
And he fought John Hess in Hawaii, who had fought in the UFC, and beat the fuck out of him in about 10 seconds. Yeah. It was like one of the craziest fights ever. He got on top of him and just, I think he went knee to the belly on him and just uncorked about 50 punches to his face. Like, nobody had seen anybody like Vitor.
He was a horrible monster.
He's still fighting this fucking weekend, which is so crazy. Vitor is fighting this weekend for the title.
Yeah.
It's madness. Yeah. But, so that's, I just was, and then I immediately upon going to Carlson Gracie's, I was just manhandled and thrown around like a little baby mm-hmm. and strangled left and right. I was like, Jesus Christ, I'm fucking helpless. Yeah. I had this delusional idea that I could defend myself.
Yeah.
But as a white belt in jiu-jitsu, even with a year of high school wrestling, I kind of like knew how to wrestle a little.
Yeah.
I knew how to like get on top of guys, and then I'd get triangled or armbarred or guillotined, and they'd take my back. And, you know, I didn't know what the fuck to do with the gi. The gi was ridiculous.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah.
Wrapping me up in that thing and just, ugh, it was so humiliating.
Yeah.
I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
But also so enlightening.
Oh.
And for you, going from this karate background to then entering into mixed martial arts training,
mm-hmm.
like, what was...
Well, I'd never been punched in the face, for one thing.
In all your karate training? No one punched you in the face?
Mm-mm. We always threw punches to the chest.
Because it's Kyokushin.
Kyokushin, yeah.
Wow, so you never I mean, put that's boxing gloves on and fucked around?
Maybe we did, but not for real. I mean, the level, the intensity of sparring at the MMA gym was so much more intense. So maybe we put boxing gloves on and threw some punches, but very soft.
Wow.
You know, and there's days at the MMA gym where it's very, very close to being, you know, a real fight in there.
Often is a real fight.
Yeah, it's pretty close to being a real fight. Yeah. It's
Cain Velasquez and Daniel Cormier, who's also fighting this weekend, Cormier said, sometimes me and Cain spar and sometimes we fight.
Yeah. Like, well, I think he actually said that. That in the old days, we fought. We always fought. Now, sometimes we spar.
Well, that's a big concern today. The big concern is, like, how much do you take out of yourself in the gym?
It's
and
tough.
How much is it necessary, though? Like, in order to prepare to be comfortable in the cage and to fight at your best, how much do you have to take out of your system?
Man, it is a tough decision. Because if they go easy, they're afraid that their guy's going really hard all mm-hmm. the time. If they go hard, there's a...
Yeah.
I mean, what is it? It's practically a coin flip that they're going to get through to the fight without getting injured in some way.
Well... One of the best gyms, American Kickboxing Academy, Dana White was just talking about how they train like cavemen, like they got to get out of Stone Age.
Yeah.
You know, and they kind of said, look, you know, you kind of don't realize what's necessary to prepare for fights. But mm-hmm. then you look at the amount of guys that get hurt there.
Yeah.
It is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But you look at the amount of guys that are really good there. Luke Rockhold, Daniel Cormier, Cain Velasquez. Yeah. Like, that's fuck, you can't argue with that success.
Yeah.
And it seems to me like there is no easy way out of this. I don't think you can train light.
The problem is, like, other sports would have this problem, except they have an authority that governs it and makes everyone behave the same way. So the NFL, for instance, or the NCAA, like football teams, for instance, they're allowed to practice so many hours a week, and that's it.
Really?
Yeah, it's by rule. You know, you're not allowed, you put in your 20 or 30 hours a week, and then that's it.
Allowed to train on your own?
Well, I guess you could.
That's the problem.
And guys will cheat and go,
Well, that's a problem with fighting. Fighting is a team sport? No. Fighting's an individual sport.
Right.
So anytime anybody goes, well, the people in the NFL, well, listen, people in the NFL, first of all, that fucking whistle blows and you get a nice juicy break.
Yeah.
You know, you get to catch your breath, walk around offsides. You get that guy talks.
TV timeout.
He says a bunch of shit that went wrong and everybody complains and... It's a joke if you compare the amount of effort you have to put forth in an NFL. Sure, the collisions are horrific. Sure, you mean you got to work out hard to be that fucking big and strong. There's no doubt about it. But as for like the life and death experience of being in the cage, fuck, man.
No, I don't think anything compares to
There's nothing.
Yeah.
There's nothing. Now, how did you start off with beginner classes? Like, how did you enter into this?
No, I mean, basically, this gym, it's a small gym. You know, it's a small town
gym. How many students, really?
It would vary, you know. Like you said, MMA is a tough business. An MMA gym is a tough business. And so it might be booming in popularity as a spectator sport. Doesn't mean most guys want to get in there and start training.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't look like all that much
like
fun.
Opening up a base jumping school.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
I think he expected, as a lot of guys who open those gyms did, that the level of popularity as a spectator sport would track with the level of participation. So maybe like most nights would be 15 guys there, something like that.
That's not too bad.
It's not too bad, yeah.
And did you ever have an issue with the guys who were more experienced beating up on the guys who weren't?
I mean, honestly, sometimes, but honestly, not for the most part. You know, there's a very clear pecking order emerges in an MMA gym,
mm-hmm.
or any kind of martial arts gym, almost from day one. People have a very good sense, a very, very good sense, of who would kick whose ass if it came down to a real fight.
Mm.
And so for the most part, the big guys don't bully or oppress the little guys. There's no glory in it.
Right.
And the little guys also know not to antagonize the big guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they give them respect. They give them submissive body language. You know, one time I was going to fight or spar this big heavyweight in my gym. And we often had to spar out of our weight class because it is a smaller gym. So this guy weighs like 270 pounds. He's a competition fighter. I'm terrified. And in the moment before the bell rings, I go right up to him and I hug him. Right? And I bury my head right in his fragrant, meaty cleavage. And I say, "Come on, Clark. I got a family." That's all I said, you know. And after that, you know, he didn't exactly go easy on me, but he let me live, you know. So, and that happens, you know, I was pretty explicit about it, but I think that kind of language, that kind of communication mm-hmm. is going on a lot at a gym.
Yeah, it certainly is. It does in jiu-jitsu as well. Like, you'll see some guys that, like, as they're rolling, they're just more submissive to other guys. You know, like when someone is more dominant, it's like there's certain things you don't even try.
Yeah.
You'll automatically go on defensive mode, which is also very dangerous for the guy who's the best guy in the gym, because you can get a very inflated sense of
Absolutely.
Your abilities.
Absolutely.
If you're always – it's like there's certain fighters that fought in lower-level organizations and then came over to the UFC.
Mm-hmm.
And as they came over to the UFC, one of the first things that was clear was that they had never faced another killer.
Yeah.
Like, they might be a killer themselves,
yeah.
but they had never faced another killer.
They're
not getting- then when face a killer in the UFC, they'd be like, "Oh, this is mm-hmm. what it's like to fight me. Mm-hmm. This sucks." And you would often find out,
no, that's
like,
true. That's
who's,
true.
Who's got yeah. it and who doesn't have
that's
it.
That's true. At my gym, that's definitely true.
Yeah, they call them
the better guys there. I don't hit those guys harder than face. No way.
Yeah, you don't want
to. No way. Then you authorize them to hit you harder than the face.
Yeah, well, Carlos Condit said that once. He did this this thing for the military and did some sparring and stuff with some the military guys. And he's real clear. He goes, "Hey, man," he goes, "we can have some fun here. Just hit me as hard as you want to get hit."
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
When you're that good and you can yeah. say, "Just hit me as hard as you want to get hit. Don't hit that guy yeah. hard.
Yes.
Trust me."
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But that's, you know, it's finding that perfect balance of competition. But of also, you know, like, you got to figure out how to not kill each other
mm-hmm.
inside the gym. You got to mm-hmm. compete and push each other.
Yeah.
And oftentimes it's just a matter of just pulling back on shots, of not mm-hmm. trying to mm-hmm. knock each other out. Because the guys who try to knock each other out, man, that style of sparring that just cannot maintain.
No, I think it's really dumb. There are guys in my gym like that, guys who apparently can't pull the punch. Either by lack of athleticism, you know what I mean? It's kind of mm-hmm. actually a hard thing to throw the punch as hard as you can.
There are a few guys
like
that.
And then pull it at the very last second. That's mm-hmm. kind of an athletic thing to be able to pull off.
Yeah.
I hate sparring with those guys.
There's always a guy like that. There's guys like that in jiu-jitsu, too, that guys would never spar with.
Mm-hmm.
There was this one dude, no need to name names, but at Jean-Jacques Machado's, we'd all just get away from this guy. Because if you
yeah.
sparred with him, if he caught you in anything, he's going to fuck your arm up or
yeah,
fuck
yeah,
your
yeah.
neck up.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he just would not let go,
yeah.
and he didn't know how to not yank on things.
Right.
And then there's other guys that were way better than him that you never worried about. Like, you might get dominated. You might get tapped. Like,
yeah.
Like, if you roll with Jean-Jacques Machado, even if you get tapped, it's so controlled.
Right.
Like, you never get hurt.
Right, right, right.
You know, like, if he wraps you up in a triangle or takes your back or something like that, like, He's in control the entire time. Yeah. There's no yanking or weird shit or twisting that you didn't expect. And those are like the dangerous guys. They're like the strong blue belts.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, those are the guys at my gym too. Where there's guys who are like, there's guys that can't quite spar. That you have to fight them. You know what I mean? They're going to come so hard that you almost have to fight them.
Yeah.
And that I don't want to do that.
Are you still doing it? Are you still after you wrote the book?
I did. You know, this was a big thing that this was the big surprise for me about doing this whole project was, again, I look at it from across the street. I'd always been a fan, but I never really wanted to do it myself. I wanted to do jiu-jitsu, but I didn't really want to be a cage fighter. It didn't look like fun to me. It looked like about as much fun as torture. You know what I mean? It looked scary and painful. And the biggest shock for me was that I loved it. I loved it. So I expected to do it for a year and then to quit the absolute second my fight was over. you know, just, that's it. I'm retired. I'll go write the book. But I kept doing it for a couple years longer because I really loved it. I loved the camaraderie. I loved the challenge of it. I loved the way it made me feel. I loved the way it you know, gave me this ability to live a sort of headlong life. You know, for a couple hours a week is all.
What do you mean by headlong?
I don't know. I have this restraint in my life. I'm a professor. You know, I have this really dull life in a lot of ways. And then for a few hours a week, I go in and I take these risks in the gym and I experience these big emotions and these big highs, you know. And then about a year ago, I was so beat up that I really just couldn't continue anymore. And giving up was one of the hardest things I've ever done. It was like, you know, I kind of felt like this romance in my life had come to an end. And I was too brittle and too old, you know, to recapture it.
What was the issue, like physically?
I always expected for it to end badly. You know, I knew I was kind of pushing my luck, and I figured I'd go out on my shield at some point, you know, go out on a stretcher after some horrible head injury or blow out my knee or something like that. It wasn't like that, though. It was more like an accumulation of little things. Rickety old man stuff, you know? You just get older and you start picking up these little injuries and they don't go away. So I got, you know, I kept getting turf toe. From kicks and from getting stuck on the mat. And that turned into arthritis at some point. And I've pulled my groin bad, and that's been bad. And I messed up my neck one time, and it's never been quite the same. Just got rickety. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason I've started going to hot yoga, as we said before, is in hopes of curing all this stuff, you know, getting physically healthy, getting my flexibility better so I can get back in the gym. I don't ever want to do the hardcore MMA sparring anymore. I don't want to get hit in the head anymore. But I do want to get back into the grappling elements of it.
Yeah, we were talking about it before the podcast started that I've become addicted the last few weeks to yoga.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I've got this reoccurring issue. Well, I have a pulled muscle in my butt. Very uncomfortable to talk about, but it's aggravated when I throw kicks, and so I wasn't throwing kicks for a while. But there's certain punches when I just push off of it. It just there's something about exploding. So I was like, man, I gotta stretch out. My back's always fucked up, and so I started taking hot yoga like about a week and a half ago, and like almost immediately, I found out that it calmed me down. Like almost immediately, it was like my stress level just dropped tremendously. I mean, I had done it before, but I've been real inconsistent about it. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to do 4 days a week for like a year. That's
my goal too. Yeah. That's my goal. Can you do it on back-to-back days?
Yeah, you can.
I often feel so tired from it on the second day, like muscularly tired. I mean, the thing that I didn't expect about yoga is how difficult it is.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew it was like I thought it was being a hot room stretching. That's what I thought it was. You know what I mean? But it is. I mean, the level of exertion is really extraordinary.
It's harder than a lot of jiu-jitsu classes.
Yeah.
And people are going to say, get the fuck out of here. Yeah. If I have to roll with 5 blue belts that are my size or do a class in hot yoga, I guarantee you it's harder to do yoga.
Yeah.
Because if a guy's under my level, I can pretty much control what happens. Right. You know, I could hold positions. I could choose to take breaks. Yeah. You know, I can mount them and just relax.
Just
you know?
There.
Yeah. You can't do that, obviously, if you're fighting for your life.
No.
You can't against someone good.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're grappling with someone really good, jiu-jitsu is harder because it's fighting to the death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's someone who's just a little bit better than you or a solid notch better than you and they're trying to kill you and you're constantly on the – but they're not good enough that you're in total defensive mode.
Right.
You're
still in the game.
You get to heart attack stages where you're like, this might end right here. This whole fucking life on this planet might end right here for me.
It'd be a good death for you.
It's not the worst death. Yeah. But yoga is almost as difficult. It's really hard. I mean, I was going to write something about it. Like, I might write it still, like a blog entry about how there's this life or death struggle that's going on in these hot rooms all over the country, and no one knows mm-hmm. how difficult it really is. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks it's like really easy because a bunch of women are doing it.
Exactly. Exactly. I think guys don't get it at all, because I'm always there, and it's, and I kind of like the female environment of it.
Yeah.
I like that it's such a big transition from the gym, you know, where like it's non-competitive, and the whole, even if there's a male teacher, the whole culture is still female, you know? It's mm-hmm. like a, it's a feminine culture. It's like, it's none of the macho stuff is going
right,
on there.
And right,
like, you're not trying to vanquish the room at hot yoga like you would be possibly if you were at the gym, you know? And so I just dig it. And I think it's the main thing that people don't get about it. Because I would have had the same stereotypes I think that a lot of people have. That's kind of a sissy thing to do. There's nothing mm-hmm. sissy about it. It's really a hard thing.
Yeah, it just has a weird connotation for some reason. There's a weird, we have this weird perception of it because we see girls in tights.
Yeah.
You know, and we say, how hard could they be working?
Exactly.
That's ridiculous. A bunch of chicks.
I do get the feeling that I am working harder. Because I'm newer. And I have to work really hard to get into these positions because I'm not, my flexibility sucks. And with these women, a lot of them are super flexible, and they seem to get into those positions pretty effortlessly mm-hmm. and hold them with less vibration than I'm holding them. You know
well,
what I mean?
Some for sure, but some. I mean, there's this one lady that I go to this class, and she's got to take a break like every other pose. She's barely getting through it.
Yeah.
You know, she's very out of shape, and she's attempting to do this very difficult class. And there's certain things when I do it where I'm like, fucking, I could barely hang in here until this guy calls it.
I know, me too.
But in other ones, it's a breeze where other people are really struggling.
It depends on the instructor, you mean?
No.
The
flexibility.
Poses. Yeah.
Like, I have a lot of flexibility in my legs, like kicking flexibility. Yeah. And so there's certain poses where everybody else is struggling and I'm taking a break. I'm like, woo, I can relax here.
Can you get your arms back?
Yeah, I can do all that. But the big one is like stretching my legs out and putting my body forward where with a lot of people they're holding it. I'm like, I can go to sleep here.
Yeah.
So it's nice, I get little breaks.
No, for me I'm fighting for my life in that position.
Yeah.
And having that voice in my head is you know like, you can do it, pussy. Mm-hmm. Don't be a pussy.
Don't be a pussy. But then there's other ones where I'm just fucking dying, you know? It's really difficult. But, you know, again, I think there's a balance issue. And I think when you're all the time just all the explosion, lifting weights, kettlebells, and fucking I think it's good to do like static tension relieving, long holding those poses, stretching, elongating the muscles, stretching out all the tissue, stretching out all the hamstrings and the back muscles. And there's so much stretching going on. I realize what I'm doing, and I'm like, I don't ever do this. I never lengthen everything out. Everything is just getting compressed.
Yes, exactly.
Everything is everything is explosion and all this fucking heavy weight.
Yeah.
And there's I think you need balance. I don't think you should have only yoga. Like, I think it's good to put weight on your body and your muscles because it's good for your density of your bones. It maintains mass. It keeps you from getting frail, especially as you get older. But I think stretching and yoga positions should be almost mandatory for people to get their shit together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes you way calmer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why. I mean, I wonder if it's just physical tension being released. Or if just stretching itself, if there's something in the act of doing so that just when it's over, everything else just seems like calm and relaxed. Like the difficulty of those poses.
Yeah. I always felt like it was it burns through so much energy. You don't have anything left to torture yourself with afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, the anxiety is kind of burnt through. And no, I had the same sense that you do. The first time I did it, I was like, oh my God, this is the healthiest thing I've ever done in my life.
How long have you been doing it?
Like, I've done like 10 classes.
Yeah.
So I'm still at that stage of like, you know, convert's zeal, you know?
Oh yeah. The blue belt disease.
Yeah.
Like just before you get a blue belt, jiu-jitsu guys just don't want to talk about anything but jiu-jitsu.
Right. Yeah.
So you want to do it to a point where you get healthy enough to go back to grappling.
Yeah, I'd like to get back into the gym. Yeah, I miss the guys. I miss the – it was a good thing for me.
You know, Anthony Bourdain just got into jiu-jitsu. Do you know this?
I did that. Yeah, I did know that. Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
At 58.
Yeah. I know. He loves it, too.
Dude, when I met him, that fucking guy –
he's got a blue belt disease.
He still smoked a few cigarettes when I met him, drank crazily.
Has he quit smoking?
Drank a lot. Yeah, he quit smoking.
Really?
He quit smoking when he had his daughter. which was just right, I guess right around when I was meeting him, and was just eating whatever the fuck he wanted to, getting, you know, a belly and drinking all the time and traveling around the world. And then his wife is a maniac. His wife is a jiu-jitsu fiend.
Yeah.
But I see a guy like that, I'm like, at 58 years old, like how much can his body take? He's doing it like twice a day.
Yeah.
I wonder if he's doing any yoga or anything to counteract just...
I don't know.
Just age-related degeneration.
Yeah, I don't know. I often wonder that about that myself. I wonder if, like, the fact that he wasn't athletic for most of his life means that he, you know, hadn't put a lot of hard miles on himself.
That could be true.
Know, like, by now, you've got a lot of hard miles on yourself. I got quite a few hard miles on myself, you know?
Yeah, I have a lot of fucking hard miles on this body. It's a lot of surgeries and a lot of injuries, but it works amazingly well. But a lot of that is because I don't have a conventional job. I was thinking that today when I did that class. I was like, how many fucking people have an hour and a half, you know?
The middle of the day.
Yeah, or at 9 o'clock in the morning to go in there and you know, stretch out in a fucking sweat box for an hour and a half. Most people just don't have that time.
No.
And then when you get home, you have, you know, your family and bills and blah, 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 blah. And you have all this shit to deal with. Most people don't have the time to put in for body maintenance, for the proper body maintenance.
It's very true.
Like, I was having a conversation with a friend about nutrition. Like, they were asking me, like, which kind of supplement should I get? What should I do? And I said, well, one of the first things you should do is find a qualified doctor and get your blood work done. Find out where your nutrition levels are at, what your vitamin levels are. Like, let's find out, like, eat what you normally eat. You don't have to get crazy and try to fix it, but eat what you normally eat. And then let's find out what do you need, you know? Most people are like, oh, that's so much time.
Yeah, they don't have the energy and time for it.
Go to the doctor and
do the research.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. Yeah. Jobs are bullshit. That's the real problem. They're bullshit. I mean, part of what you were feeling when you saw those guys across the street and they were living their life, you realized that you were contained.
Yeah, I was literally in a box. And the professor in the cage is the cage. It's a fighting cage. But it's also my office, you know, my cubicle where I worked. And so the book is about getting out of that cubicle, you know. I was, you know, getting out of my academic cage.
If this thing sold like crazy, would you be willing to write the professor in the mat and enter into jiu-jitsu tournaments?
Yeah, for sure, man.
Professor in the yoga room?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Adventures as a wannabe yogi?
Start a franchise, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Now, what is boring about teaching English?
It wasn't that it was boring. I don't know. You know, I was teaching a lot of writing classes, especially freshman writing. And freshman writing at my college was mandatory, which means that everyone there is a captive. You know, at most college courses, you get to take whatever you want to take. There's electives. You're not forced to be anywhere. This is a class you're forced to be in. And so I was teaching freshman composition over and over and over again to students who just couldn't care less, you know. Mm. And so that was lame. The main problem, though, was like I was an adjunct. You know what an adjunct is?
Yeah.
An adjunct is like not a full-time faculty member. So, you know, for like almost 10 years, I've been making about 16 grand a year, you know, kind of chasing this dream of being a boyhood dream, really, of being a college professor, of being a scholar. I wanted to be that guy, like the guy who makes some small but meaningful contribution to knowledge. Mm-hmm. And I'd been chasing that dream for a long time and writing books and writing the articles and doing all kinds of stuff, but it just wasn't, my research was a little bit non-conventional and it just wasn't, I wasn't making it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I just didn't have the courage to quit. It wasn't, I don't know if it was a courage thing or if it was a desire thing. I don't like quitting on something that I've invested in. It's hard. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like if you're gambling, you know, you throw money in the pot, you don't want to fucking fold, even though you know you should fold. And so when I went across the street that first time, and I made that joke at my own expense, it wouldn't be funny if I went over there. Part of what was driving me to cross over there was a career suicide fantasy. I was thinking to myself, well, you apparently don't have the courage to quit your job and move on to something else. Maybe you can do something offensive enough to people in your profession that will get you fired.
Oh, my God.
And so if I showed up in the cage, everybody in my department would be able to, honest to God, like look up from the poems they were reading. You know, reading their poems, they look up, and they'd be able to see me right across the street, you know, engaged in blood sport. And they don't really approve of blood sport in English departments.
What has the reaction been amongst your peers?
Okay, career suicide fantasy, right? So I went over there thinking, I can't quit. Maybe I can get myself fired. On my campus, people were much more tolerant and open-minded than I had hoped. You know? they didn't get furious with me. They didn't try to fire me. It's because they know me. They know I'm not a savage animal. They know I'm, you know, they know I'm a decent human being. The bigger question is what effect will it have within the larger profession? Will it be an effective career suicide strategy once other people in the profession get a hold of the book? And I do think probably it'll be a success as a career suicide strategy. About 2 weeks after the book came out, this article came out about me and about the book in this magazine that no one reads in the real world, called The Chronicle of Higher Education, but it's the main trade magazine for academia. And the book comes off pretty much as a glorification of macho barbarism in their thinking. You know, a dumb glorification of butchery and barbarism. You know what I mean?
Butchery, even.
Well,
were you just using that word and they didn't use
savagery.
That word?
Savagery. Savagery and barbarism.
Sounds like it was written by a pussy. Just saying.
So that could be effective in ending my career, because that's a guy, like, I read about that and I read the article. I said to my wife, like, okay, that ends it. There it is.
Really?
Yeah.
Is he well written?
Yeah.
Was it well written? Did the guy have any points?
No, I mean,
it's not going to be well written.
Well, it's funny.
He didn't have points
because he's a good writer.
Oh, okay,
you know what I mean. But it's not. I don't think it's good journalism, but it's good writing.
Well, it's editorial. I mean, whenever
it
you
was, were, a, yeah, it was, right? it was a feature, a sort of portrait. Mm-hmm. And instead of making an actual portrait, he sort of drew a caricature, in my opinion.
A caricature of you or of
me
what,
and the book
and the
book, yeah.
Of what you're trying to accomplish, or of the sport itself.
Well, let me give you one example. So. One example he quotes in the book is, like, we're at lunch, you know, and we're having a nice time, and at some point, I lean across the table toward him, and I say to him, like this, you know, I'm across the table in an intimidating fashion.
Mm-hmm.
What would it take? What would I have to say to get you to punch me in the face?
That what you said to him, really?
Yeah, I said it to him, but... If you strip out all the damn context,
right?
So in context, the, you know, that statement is about me saying how hard it is to get guys to punch you in the face,
right?
That men are fairly peaceable, mm-hmm. men avoid conflict, they're fairly prudent about throwing their fists around.
Mm-hmm.
Most guys will go to great lengths to find a face saving way out of a violent confrontation. So within context, the statement was almost the opposite of what it made it seem like.
Right. So, in his words, you were intimidating him, and
pretty much, yeah.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's just how he took it. Some people are super uncomfortable with any idea, like any form of conflict, you know, and they would like to categorize any kind of violent interaction, even voluntary violent interaction, like a mixed martial arts competition, as being barbaric, as having no virtue, as having no there's no nobility.
I get that too, and I think I don't know if it's harder for you to get into that mind space, but it's not hard for me to get into that mind space.
The mind space of
a person who looks at that and sees no redemption in it, who sees nothing good about it.
I don't have a hard time. It's easy for me to get into it. It sounds crazy because I it's my job. I mean, I'm a mixed martial arts commentator for the UFC, but I have a problem with damage. I live a very contradictory existence.
I was going to ask you about this.
Yeah. I mean, I love watching fights. I have always loved watching fights. I love that people have this burning desire in them to do what I think is the most difficult sport in the world. I don't think there's anything even close. I think as far as the emotions that are invested in trying to win and the devastating effect of a loss, and then the actual physical damage that you take along the way, your vehicle that you're racing is your own body.
Yeah.
And unlike a race car, your body will respond only if you push it in training. You have to elevate its capacity. You have to elevate its tolerances. And you have to do that intelligently. And it has to be done with the watchful eye of trainers. And along the way, there's all these variables you have to take into account. Strength and conditioning. What kind of a body type are you dealing with? What skill set do you have? What needs to be improved? objectivity, objectively and analyzing your strengths and weaknesses, looking at your skill set, looking at the weapons that you have that you need to keep sharp, and looking at ones that you need to acquire. There's so many variables. To me, it's the ultimate problem-solving, high-level competition. I don't think there's anything like it. Yeah. But I have a problem with a lot of the asshole. I have a lot of problem with a lot of the thuggish behavior. I have a problem with, I mean, even though I know a lot of it is psychological warfare and trying to intimidate each other, I have a problem with some of that. I have a problem with the damage that guys take. I have a real problem with that.
Yeah,
I have a real problem with guys not knowing when to get out, with their friends telling them, listen, man, just got to put together one hard camp. You're like, no, he's been knocked out seven fucking times. Yeah. Like, no, he needs to preserve his brain for the rest of his life. Have you ever met an old man that used to fight? I have. It's not fun. Yeah. It's not fun at all. It's very uncomfortable to talk to a guy who tells the same fucking story over and over and over and over and over and over.
Do you know UFC fighters like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. And I know UFC fighters who didn't used to be like that, who are like that now. And they're some of my all-time favorites.
Well, this is the big question for me. I mean, let me ask one more question. The other day on the podcast, you mentioned Howard Cosell giving up that work after seeing a particularly gruesome fight.
Larry Holmes, Tex Cobb. Yeah.
You ever think that could happen to you?
It's possible. Yeah, it's possible that there'll come a day where I can't do it anymore, that I don't want to do it anymore. I'll probably always be a fan, to some extent. But my favorite guy is Mighty Mouse. You know, people think my all-time favorite guys are some of the craziest. Like Wanderlei Silva is one of my all-time favorites. Just because his fights were fucking chaos. Yeah. You knew if you're going to watch a Wanderlei Silva fight, that dude across the ring, and he's wiggling his wrists back in the Pride days doing this shit. Yeah. I mean, he was probably one of the best middleweights ever, or light heavyweight in that division. It's 203. But they called it middleweight. They called they called the 185-pound division was welterweight. I think. But Wanderlei, who was just the opposite of Mighty Mouse. Mighty Mouse is my favorite currently because he fights so fucking intelligently. Everything he does, his movement, his footwork, his positioning, he's always in condition. His conditioning is insane. They can just push guys to the point where they just cannot keep up with him. And his technical superiority over all of the competition is just so obvious. Yeah. And his work ethic, his intelligence, he's a great role model. When you hear him talk, he's a very intelligent young man, but also humble and friendly. I mean, he does. You see him. The only thing that tells you that guy's a martial arts fighter is his ears.
Yeah.
You look at him, he seems so friendly and so nice, but then he gets in there. He's the baddest motherfucker in the world, pound for pound, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I think
he's just 125 pounds.
Yeah.
He
doesn't get the attention because of that.
No. But, you know, other than that, Fedor, who is just violence. Every one of his fights was violent. But intelligence. And Anderson, who was just a wizard.
Yeah.
Anderson in his prime was the wizard of all wizards.
Yeah.
He would pull off things where you just go, get the fuck out of here. What did I just see?
My favorite has always been Machida.
Machida's great, too.
I just there's a beauty and grace to the way he fights. He reminds me of a matador. He kind of looks like a matador. You know, he's got that kind of dark complexion and dark hair. And
I think Machida spent too much of his career at fighting at 205.
I totally agree. He's too small for 185.
Which is crazy.
Rockhold dwarfs him.
Rockhold's a giant.
And you know, who's Weidman is way bigger, too.
I just don't know.
And he's about to fight Romero, who's going to dwarf him, too. Romero's huge. So he's taking abuse from these huge guys.
Yeah. I just don't know how he fought at 205 for so long. He would weigh in at 203 and, not cut any weight at all and then fight Tito Ortiz.
Who weighed 230 or something,
He's a
right?
big, giant dude. Yeah. I mean, he fought Thiago Silva, who was huge at 205. He fought some big-ass fucking dudes. But he fought very brilliantly. But he's also, he's in his late 30s. I think he's 37 or 38. And your body just, you only have so many miles.
Yeah.
You know, there's just, you don't get to change the tires.
Yeah.
You don't get to upgrade the suspension.
Yeah, he's taken some abuse.
Well, the Rockhold fight was the most abuse he's ever taken.
Fight. Yeah, I didn't like that fight.
I mean, Jon Jones choked him out.
Yeah.
And when a guy chokes you out like that, that's not nearly as bad Shogun KO'd him essentially with one punch.
Yeah.
So those were like two big losses before, but this Rockhold fight was a fucking molestation.
Right.
It was a brutal, yeah. I mean, yeah, I shouldn't say that word. I should say it was an assault.
Yeah.
That's what it was. It was brutal.
That's what I didn't like about that fight. By the end, it was an assault on a helpless victim. And yeah. I feel like you were saying this too, that's a fight that should have been ended probably on the stool.
I agree.
You know, his corner should have ended it.
Well, they didn't even put his mouthpiece in for the second round. We didn't know about it. He was saying something to the referee and pointing at his mouth, and I was trying to figure out what
while they were squaring off?
Or? While they were in, when he was on the bottom and Rockhold was beating him up,
yeah.
he pointed, said to the referee something and pointed to his mouth that he didn't have a mouthpiece in, and the referee didn't pick it up.
Wow.
I mean, you got to check that.
Yeah.
The corners, it's their ultimately their fault, but the referee fucked up too.
Yeah.
You can't let a guy fight and get the shit beat out of him with no mouthpiece in.
Well, can we go back to that question about the conflict you feel between being a sports a fan of this sport,
sure.
a massive fan of this sport. No one's a bigger fan than you. I'm a huge fan of the sport too. But also that sense of dividedness, that I mean, here's how I feel about it. It's like I feel like we're trapped in this kind of devil's bargain. You know, we love the sport. We admire the athletes, even worship them. We admire their heroism, their courage, their skill, their stamina, all of it. And we love the drama of it. We love the savagery of it. We love the technique of it. But at the same time, we know it costs these guys too much. And I guess my question is there any way out of this devil's bargain? Is there a way that we can make this sport safer than it is?
Well, I think you and I are both in agreement with the gloves issue, and you wrote something about it, and I discussed it with Sam Harris. I've discussed it with a bunch of people. I feel like, and this would kind of be contradictory for people who don't train in martial arts, but I'll try to explain it visually for people who watch this, which is a much smaller percentage of the population. If you look at someone's wrist, your wrist, when you hit things, your wrist tends to wiggle around. It flexes, and it's very hard to keep your wrist stiff and hit things hard, and especially repeatedly when you're bouncing your wrist off of elbows and shoulders and even foreheads. You tend to break your hands much easier if you don't have wraps. And when you see a fighter in the UFC and they have those gloves aren't really protecting the other opponent. The opponent, the person you're punching, nearly as much as they're protecting the person who's punching the opponent. But the big thing to me is not just the gloves, it's the wraps.
Yeah.
I feel like when you tape up your wrist.
You cast it.
Yeah. You tape up your wrist, you tape up your hands, you make that thing hard as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
Before I work out, before I hit the bag or hit the pads or anything like that, I tape this fucking bitch down. I go in between my knuckles.
Yeah.
I have these pads that I put over my knuckles, and I tape over them. And then I go everything with athletic tape. And at the end of it, that fucking thing, and you can slam things with it. And it's unnatural.
Yeah.
You have an unnatural situation with your hands. And when people say, well, it looks barbaric if you bare knuckle. Let me tell you something. You would be way better off with me bare knuckle punching you than you would with me kicking you with my shin.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally legal.
Yeah.
We head kicks, heel, like when you see like Terry Etim versus Edson Barboza and Edson Barboza wheel kicks him in the head.
Yeah.
There is not a fucking punch that's ever been thrown by a human being ever that has the kind of power that a fucking wheel kick has.
Yeah.
Your legs are, I mean, especially not that weight class. I mean, you'd have to have like the biggest, most giant heavyweight boxer. And still, I don't think they could probably punch as hard as a world-class kickboxer can throw a kick like that.
Those kicks are rare, though. I mean,
one
of the things that was interesting to me is there's a paper out in some journal, like the Canadian Journal of Criminology. Not criminology, sorry. Sports medicine or something like that. Went through all the UFC fights over, a decade. And saw how they ended. And when it came to KOs and TKOs, 85% of them were from the hands. So my feeling is, again, people have the wrong idea about these gloves. They really have the wrong idea. They think it makes the sport safer. They think it can make it safer. And it does make it safer for the guy's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And the cost of that is making it exponentially more dangerous for the other guy's brain. If you take those gloves off, those guys cannot throw their hands around like that.
No.
If you glove it up, you tape it up, you turn that fragile, vulnerable fist into a brutally dangerous cudgel. Mm-hmm. You can throw around from all these different angles. You can throw Roy Nelson style mm-hmm. overhand rights. You can't throw that punch without gloves on.
You'll break your hand.
Instantly. You KO yeah. yourself. Because yeah. the skull, if you punch the skull with a bare hand, the skull punches you back.
Yeah. If you hit someone, if someone just ducks down and you hit them with a straight punch on the forehead, it's like punching a wall.
So to me, there was this tragedy that happened. And it happened in boxing. It happened in boxing in 1867. You know, boxing was on the verge of getting outlawed, basically, for being savage. And they said, okay, well, we'll change the rules. We'll add these different elements. We'll make it possible for the referees to stop fight. And we'll put pillows on the guy's fists. So it was a well-intended thing. It's a well-intended thing where a well-intended humanitarian gesture. We'll make the sport safer by putting these pillows on these guys' hands. And the UFC made exactly the same mistake 130 years later or something. They were on the verge of getting outlawed. They were having all kinds of political problems. And so they reformed. They said, well, we're going to outlaw these really brutal-looking techniques, and we are also going to take away the prime symbol in the public's mind of the savagery of cage fighting, which is bare-fisted fighting. Even in our language, when we say we're going to take the gloves off,
right.
That means we're going to resort to a really primitive style of brutality. So it was a well-intended gesture that backfired in a tragic way. So people think that the sort of savagery and the damage and the danger, the neurological danger especially, of fighting is intrinsic to the sport and unavoidable. And it's not really true. You could massively decrease the danger, the neurological danger of the sport just by taking off the gloves.
But could you, because a big percentage of the blows that guys receive, they receive in training, and you're very unlikely to train bare knuckle. So you're going to still, you could still get tagged.
You're right. You're right.
There's also, it impedes grappling in a lot of ways.
The gloves do. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
They get in the way of a lot of chokes. They get in the way.
You can grab them. They're mm-hmm. handles. Mm-hmm. You can't get them in. And I mean, you close your neck up. You can't get your gloves in.
Some guys use them intelligently to actually finish chokes. I've seen Josh Thompson, who's a very clever fella. He's done rear naked chokes where he reaches under his own gloves and chokes guys and finishes
legal?
It. It's questionable. I'm not sure.
You can't reach inside the other guy's glove.
You can't reach inside the other guy's glove, but I think you can grab your own glove.
Or you can grab your shorts.
You can grab your shorts to defend yourself.
Yeah.
You can't grab your shorts to finish a technique, though, I don't think. I don't think.
Yeah.
I think if you had, like, there is a position that you could get where you could have your arm wrapped around a guy's neck and grab your own shorts.
Yeah.
And use your own shorts to aid in the choke. I wonder if you could do that. I wonder if you could do it offense. I probably should know this, seeing as I do it for a living. But I know that you can use it defensively, which is big with kimuras.
Yeah.
If a guy's going for a shoulder lock and you reach deep into your shorts and you hold on to him, it can be just enough to protect you, to keep you from getting tapped.
Yeah. But I think, you know, if you take the gloves off too, I've argued with some people about this. They're like, well, if you did that, and guys would just throw more kicks, they'd throw more knees, they'd throw more elbows.
They would. It would be more like bare knuckle Muay Thai.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I think paradoxically taking the gloves off would also weaken all the other weapons. Because it's really hard to kick somebody in the head.
If you're Donald Cerrone.
Well, but partly it's because they have to respect his fists. They have to have a lot of respect for his fists. Well,
yeah, but it's also like you get close to him, you get kneed, like you get elbowed. You know, I kind of disagree with that because I think it really just depends upon what kind of skill set you get into MMA with.
Yeah.
If you get a guy who's a really good kicker and you take away the gloves, you just made his kicks better. Because now he doesn't have to worry nearly as much about the other guy's punches.
Oh, he doesn't have to worry. That's true. That's a good point. I was thinking that the other guy... the defender wouldn't be as vulnerable to the kick because he can look for the kick more because he doesn't have to beware of the other guy's fist. But you're right, the kicker doesn't have to worry about it. That's a good point.
Okay. One of the biggest problems with the gloves is the fact that the fingers are wide open and guys are poking each other in the eye all the time.
Yeah,
it's a huge issue. The UFC's tried to figure out a way to do it, to mitigate it, to have the same gloves, but make something where they curve more. I think Bellator came out with this Everlast glove that I think has two opposing benefits. Like, it's more curved, which I think is better to avoid some of the pokes, like the old Pride gloves.
Yes. Yeah.
But also, it's got more padding on the top to protect the knuckles so they have less broken hands. But that means to me that guys can punch harder. So it's like you're more free to punch, but you're less likely to poke. I will take that. I'll take the less likely to get the eye pokes, because I think the eye pokes that's a huge tragic issue.
Yeah.
For people who aren't familiar with the sport, Muay Thai, the art of Thai boxing, they have a very specific style of using the hands. Well, they'll like put the hands on the forehead and they'll throw knees. They'll put the hands up and they'll throw kicks. They'll put the hand. They have a lot, especially in different practitioners. They have a lot of ways of using. But when they're doing it in the gym or in the ring, they're usually wearing big boxing gloves, mm-hmm. and the boxing gloves don't have anything free to poke.
Yeah.
But fingers. In the MMA gloves, the fingers are completely exposed. And when guys utilize the same techniques to try to keep a guy off them, they oftentimes wind up poking guys right in the eyes, and they cause irreparable damage. Like guys like Alan Belcher, he's been out of the UFC for a long time. He had knee eye surgery, like significant eye surgery. Michael Bisping had significant eye surgery. He has oil in his eye,
Bisping does.
Yeah, dude, when you look at one of his eyes, it's a different color.
Yeah.
It's like you don't see his pupil.
Yeah.
And it's to protect his retina.
Yikes.
But he's such a fucking gangster. That guy's still in there throwing down with one bum eye.
I know. I wish he... It's again, though, like, when should these guys quit? You
know? Well, he's still world class, clearly, you know? I mean, he's still... He just beat CB Dalloway, and he showed he's still world class. He's still, you know, one of the best guys in the world. A Kung Lee victory. I mean, that guy has a chance. I mean, he really does have a chance still. He really has a dream, and that dream is to be a world champion. And that mindset that he has that allows him to fight with one fucked up eye, you know, through all. And he has got something wrong with his neck. I mean, he's always, like, banged up. You know, he's been fighting forever.
Yeah.
He's also been fighting clean. And a lot of his major losses are from guys who weren't clean.
I know. That's sad.
Even if they weren't legally clean, I mean, even if what they were doing was legal, like Henderson and Vitor,
they
still weren't clean. Chael Sonnen. Wasn't clean. I mean, all these guys
almost
were not clean.
Beat him, right?
Yeah, almost everybody who beat him, except Rockhold.
Yeah.
Rockhold's just a fucking freak of nature.
Yeah,
freak of nature and a freak of training with Cain Velasquez and Daniel Cormier every fucking day.
Yeah.
You know, he's just so goddamn good and long and strong.
I couldn't believe how big and strong he was compared to Machida.
You know, Javier Mendez was. We were talking about it after the fight. I was like, God damn! I was congratulating them. I was like, that was insane. And they're like, you know, what people don't realize about him is he's fucking strong. And it's very rare that you get someone who's real long but also really strong.
Yeah.
I don't know what the fuck he weighs when he actually gets in there, but it ain't 185.
He looked giant,
dude. He dwarfs me. I weigh 200 pounds, and I mean, I know I'm fat, but when I stand next to him, I'm like, get the fuck out of here! How are you 185? He's 6'4", and he looks like he's about 220 when he gets into the cage. It's insane. I don't know how he makes that weight.
Yeah, I don't either.
I have no idea how he makes that fucking weight. But he does it,
and
he can fight hard.
That's the other thing, you know, with the gloves, you could, you know, talking about ways of making the sport safer, that's another one. I think that, you know, the weight cutting issue is big.
How do you stop that?
It's impossible to stop, probably, but, you know, to me, like, the first guy to die in the UFC is just as likely to die in the sauna.
Well, it's come very close.
Yeah.
There's been a few guys backstage that fainted. They blacked out, and they pulled out of fights because they couldn't. Yeah, Henan Barao was a big one. That was a big one because a rematch with TJ Dillashaw, the fight was one of the fights of the year, one of the upsets of the entire history of the UFC, one of the biggest upsets. Spectacular performance by TJ Dillashaw. Henan Barao trains like a monster, ready for this comeback, and then passes out in the sauna or the bathtub, I guess, and cracked his head off the wall, and they wouldn't let him fight him. He knocked himself out trying to get up out of the tub.
Yeah,
I felt like that in yoga today, man. I felt like I was going to black out.
Did you really?
No, but I mean, it's like elevated
by
a thousand. Yeah, yeah.
I do feel like I'm going to pass out on the headstand.
I realized what a bitch I am when I'm like grabbing my toes and I'm like, God, I need a break. It's too hot in here. I mean, you think about like what these guys have to do in the fucking sauna to drop 20 pounds of water weight, and that they do it every 3 or 4 months.
Yeah, I did. I only had one actual fight. But I cut weight twice because the first fight I showed up to, and my opponent, fearing the legendary fistic prowess of English professors, he backed out.
He backed out the day of?
Day of.
So
I got on the scale and everything. I'm looking around. My guy's not there. And, you know, I was scared. You know, it's nerve-wracking to fight. But after you've gone through the weight cut, man, you don't want to not fight.
Right. What was wrong with him?
he just didn't show up. You know, it's small time amateur shows, and right. a lot of guys just say, hey, you know, well, this seemed like a good idea a couple months ago, but, you know, as it got close, he wasn't hurt or anything.
We had a guy from our gym that would have panic attacks, and there was a couple fights. One fight where he almost couldn't do it. Like, he was just falling apart backstage, and went out there and did it, but he lost. He got beat up pretty bad. But then another fight where he just pulled out backstage, day of the fight, getting prepped, warming up, wrapping the hands, holding it. I can't do that. I fucking can't
Holy
do this.
Holy cow, really?
You know, it happens at the UFC.
Wow.
It happens at the UFC, and people don't know. You know, there's guys that wind up fighting, and there's guys that are pretty highly ranked. Mm. I mean, I don't want to name any names, but Brendan Schaub and I were actually having a conversation about this the other day, about guys that were warming up while he was back there, and they would say to their coach, I don't want to fucking do this anymore. I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. And like, dude, you got to fight in an hour, you know?
But then they go out.
And they go out. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, that's amazing to me, because part of the reason I fought finally was because of the social pressure. Like, once you've started off down this path, it becomes like this thing where, like, you've told people you're going to do it, and everybody at the gym knows you're going to do it. So one time I kind of tried to back out. You know, like months before my actual fight, I said, you know, other writers have done this, and, you know, I'm all hurt, you know, there's no reason to do it. And I went in and told one of the guys at the gym that I was kind of leaning away from doing it. He's like, well, so you're pussying out, huh? and then I told another guy, and he said, well, so you're pussying out, huh? So everybody's kind of said that, and it becomes this huge pressure, like, to do it. And I felt like this, I felt more fear of a failure in courage than I did of the sort of whatever was going to happen to me in the cage, breaking my nose or whatever. I felt much more fear that I would just find a way to chicken out in the end. I'd get cold feet. I'd refuse to climb the steps, you know, and get in the cage. Maybe I'd run for it in the cage, just sprint in circles around the outside, jump over the fence, run for home. You know, I honestly thought that could happen, you know?
Wow.
So I can relate. It's kind of amazing me that guy backed out backstage, because there's so much. At that point, the whole warrior society sees you doing it. You know what I mean?
Mm.
It's a big blow.
Maybe he's injured.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes guys are injured, and then they get there and they realize, like, I can't fucking
do this.
I can't move my leg right.
Yeah,
you know?
This is dumb. Yeah.
There's a lot of guys who fight. That's another thing. A lot of guys who fight in the UFC that are fucked up. They're really injured by the time they get in there. I know guys who have torn ACLs, where their ACLs were completely blown out, and they really had no stability. Like, they would try to move one way or another, and their knee would just give right out.
Yeah.
And there's got to be nothing more terrifying than being in the octagon and competing against some highly trained, well prepared killer, and you can't even move right.
Yeah.
If you juke left or right, your leg's gonna go boink.
Yeah.
Have you blown out a knee before? Do you know that?
No,
feeling?
I've never done that. I've never done that.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
It's not the worst. The worst is there's obviously way worse, but it's a bad feeling, because you just know it's gonna give out. You don't know when.
Yeah.
And you go to move left or move right, and it just goes boing.
Yeah.
And ACLs, particularly, because that's the big one that goes down the center of the knee that keeps it stable moving forward, and it can blow out. On a lot of people, it blows out. It's like one of the more common knee injuries. Dominic Cruz, of course, is famously going through his second one, his third operation, second knee, though.
Yeah.
Just fucking crazy.
Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah. It's real common, though. George St. Pierre got both his knees done.
Yeah.
One of them blew out after his career was over, or after he stepped down for a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, so many Ronda's had her ACL done.
Yeah,
a lot of fighters have had their ACLs done. It's probably one of the most common injuries that fighters have in UFC.
Any sport, really. ACL seems...
Soccer, like, apparently, it's the most common.
Oh, football all the time. Basketball football. All the time. Yeah.
Yeah, the human body is just fucking, it's designed to get you to, like, age 26, and by then you're almost dead.
Yeah.
You know, saber-toothed tigers are looking for you to show up limping.
That's true.
It's just shit design, man.
Yeah. It's shit design for playing NFL football.
For punching people in the head is a shit design.
And it's a shit design for fighting for a living. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not made for that.
No.
You know, that's a bit much.
Well, when you see an NFL player, and I've only met a few of them, but when you meet them, it's like fucking, they're like giants from Game of Thrones. You're like, what?
Yeah.
That's a real person? Jesus fucking Christ. I remember one time I was in Phoenix, And we had just got done with the show. We did a comedy show at the Tempe Improv, and then we went to a bar. And when we went to a bar, there was this big line of people that were trying to get to this place. We're meeting our friend there. And one of these guys was an NFL player, and he just sort of, it was like a man amongst children.
Yeah.
He was just like moving through this crowd. He was about 6'7",
yeah.
and he was probably 350
yeah.
pounds,
yeah.
and he was so fucking big. Like, you looked at him, you just go, Jesus,
well, you feel like a girl.
Christ.
You feel like a girl. I have a friend like that, you know, he played big-time college football, and he was 6'7", 200, high 200s, and I'd stand with him at the bar, and it was like, and I'd be just looking at his tits, you know, and I'd be like, this is how you had to talk to him. I'm like, this is what it feels like for women.
Yeah.
All the time. They're looking up over this guy that can just do this.
Like, except they get turned on by them, and they want to fuck them.
That's true.
That's different. Yeah, that's I hope true. You didn't get turned on. Well, no, if you did,
that's fine.
Keep it to yourself.
That's fine. but it's more worrisome. Like, is he going to try to fuck me? Because I hope he doesn't, because I'll have no choice.
Yeah, there's no equality when it comes to physical attributes. There's certain people that were just given a way better genetic roll of the dice.
Yeah.
That's why we have weight classes. That's why Mighty Mouse can never fight John Jones. It's just, you know, the argument can take place as to who's better pound for pound, John or Mighty Mouse. And there's a lot of arguments both ways. But as far as, like, what would happen if they fight, there's no argument.
There's no argument at all.
I mean, John Jones is talented enough where he probably could fight and beat most of the heavyweights, if not all the heavyweights.
I think Yeah.
You know, this whole thing with him is so tragic.
Yeah.
It's so tragic. And, you know, more tragic for the woman he hit with his car, but so tragic for him because, you know, I don't know him well enough to know, like, where his mind's at or who he's talking to. And you hear all these bad things, like the people that he's hanging out with and the people that he surrounds himself with. And you hear some of them from his coaches. So there's got to be some validity and truth to it. But for every guy like that that's super fucking talented, it seems like it's so hard to stay on track. It's like Mike Tyson had Customato.
Yeah.
You know, and Customato was not just a great trainer, but he was also a great mental coach.
Yeah.
Like, he had instilled lessons in Mike Tyson about fire and fear and all the different aspects of competition that are going to arise, and how the hero and the coward feel the same thing. It's just the hero reacts to it differently, and then just the more you prepare your body, the less confusion you have when you get into that ring, the less doubt you have, the more clarity you have. You're 100% confident in your conditioning. You're 100% confident in your training. There will be certain fear, but you can mitigate some of that. And all this was, Customato just was a genius with Tyson. Plus, he was like a father figure. He was like a perfect example.
But John Jones had a father. He had a good father, middle class upbringing.
He still does.
You know?
No, he still does. But what I'm saying is a coach. You don't need that just in a father. I mean, his father's a great guy.
But doesn't he have that out in Albuquerque with Jackson?
So. I think he does to a certain extent. But John Jones is so fucking good.
Yeah.
The guys who train with him, the guys who talk, like if you talk to people, you're like, he's so good. He's so much better than everybody else in the gym.
Yeah.
He's so much better than that. When you saw him grab a hold of Daniel Cormier and wrestle Cormier to the ground the first round, you're like, listen, this is another fucking level
of gear.
Shit you're dealing with. You're dealing with like another level of greatness.
Yeah.
Another level of ability. And when you see a guy like that get involved and, I mean, the cocaine thing, man, that didn't bother me that much. It's like, you know, so he's doing coke 3 weeks out. He's a bad motherfucker. He wants a party. You know, that's how I look at it. You know why? Because I don't look at this as like,
no, I don't have a
Puritan.
Yeah. No, me either.
He's like, hey, let's have fun. Would I get upset if he had a drink 3 months out? No. So, or 3 weeks out, or whether how many weeks was it? How many weeks was it before the fight?
About that. That sounds right.
Four or five weeks. I don't know what it was. But would I get mad if he had a beer? Donald Cerrone drinks Budweiser up until the fucking week of his weight cut. And that's a fact.
Yeah.
And he doesn't just drink a little. He drinks a lot.
Yeah.
What's worse for you, alcohol or cocaine? Well, I don't know how much John was doing, but a little line here and there is probably not as bad as the amount of Budweiser that Donald sucks down.
That's true.
I mean, I don't fucking know, man. Yeah. I don't know. I think part of the issue that people have with a guy like John, who's just so uber talented and he's so young and all these things come handy to him, is that come so easy to him, is that when a guy like that professes to be like very moral and, you know, very religious, and then you see all this craziness like testing positive for cocaine and the drunk driving crashing into the tree with strippers in his car, it's like,
yeah.
clearly he likes to have fun, yeah. you know? Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong at all.
He's just dumb about it.
Yeah, he's being dumb about it, though, you know? So go like, party, but...
It could be that nobody can control... I mean, it's also like when you're that goddamn good, you don't want to listen to anybody. Like, you know, you're the fucking
Except
man.
There's tons of guys in the UFC and other sports who... keep it together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, George St. Pierre was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
oh, he was very disciplined.
You know,
but George fucked up too.
Kept it together.
George fucked up too. Like, George totally underestimated Matt Serra.
Yeah.
Totally underestimated Matt Serra. Got in there with him and got crushed.
Yeah.
And that's just, you got to dot your I's and cross your T's all day, every day. You can't take anyone lightly. Yeah. I've seen that many times where guys were way favored over their opponent. But they took it lightly because they were favored, and their opponent was terrified because they were the underdog.
Totally.
So they trained like a demon, and the other guy slacked off and went in there with a false sense of confidence and also a minimized sense of danger.
Yeah.
Like, nobody likes that fucking feeling, man. You went through it, right?
Yeah.
That feeling of being in the locker room, you're like, fuck, when is this over?
Yes.
Fuck, get me out there.
Yeah.
When I stopped competing, that was the one thing that I appreciated the most. Like, I didn't have to feel like I was always scared.
Yeah.
I was always like waiting for the next fight.
You know, the book is, I say it's about the duel, you know, the pistols at dawn, broadly defined, sort of mano a mano.
This is for you, man.
Thanks, buddy.
Keep that, actually.
Hey, sweet. Thank you.
A nice little mug with my face on it.
That's
think
awesome.
About me when you
That's great.
Drink your coffee.
That's great, man.
And do cocaine out of that thing.
I already think about you when I drink my coffee. But, you know, sort of about mano a mano conflict of various kinds. And, you know, so... an MMA fight is, or any kind of combat sport fight, is kind of a duel. You set it up in advance. You know, you have seconds who negotiate for you, work your corner, all that stuff, and you know, weeks out, months out, even longer, that you're going to be in a car crash at such and such a time. You know, and it weighs on you. You know, it weighs on you so heavy. Whereas, you know, if you were to walk out in the parking lot right now and some guy picked a fight with you. That would be bad, but you wouldn't have the same kind of fear, that anxiety, the build up to it. So, yeah, I was glad to get that out of my life because I lived with that for a long time because it took me a long time to get a fight. It took me a long time because I was old, and the state commission makes it pretty hard for older fighters to allow a certain matchup. And fights kept falling through, or somebody would not show up, or I would get hurt, or the other guy would get hurt. And so I lived with that sense that the fight was right around the corner for maybe 6 months.
Did it fuck with your sleep?
Oh, everything. Yeah, I just lived with this mild sense of anxiety punctuated by these stabs of terror. You know what I mean? And that's when I would start negotiating with myself, saying to myself, you know, other writers have done this before. What the hell? What's the point of this? There's no point in actually fighting. You know, you can train at the gym. You can do all that stuff. There's no point in actually having the actual fight. So I was glad to get that out of the way, and I was glad to get out of the weight management. Because that was the other hard thing about it. So for those 6 months, I was staying at a very low weight.
What were you trying to weigh in at?
Well, I started the project at close to 200 pounds. I was heavier. I was kind of fat. And then I, you know, so I could fight at 185. I could fight at 205, you know, bulk up and, you know, fight the huge guys. But I decided to fight all the way down to 170. So I cut down to where I was walking around like 180. Because at the amateurs, you don't have 24 or 30 hours, whatever it is, to rehydrate.
How much do you have?
We weighed in like at 10 o'clock in the morning for a fight. Fights that started at 7.
That day?
That day, yeah.
Whoa,
yeah.
That's dangerous.
Yeah. Well, people don't cut a lot of weight. So
How much did you cut?
I started cutting like the week of, like starving myself and mild dehydration. And by the night before my fight, I was like 176, I think. And then I got up in the morning and sweated it all out.
So you sweat out 6 pounds.
I actually overdid it. Kind of screwed up because I didn't have a scale. I had no idea how much I was actually sweating out.
Oh no.
Well, I had a scale, but you have no idea how low calorie
it is. But you cut weight and then fought the same day. That's illegal in most places.
Well, again, how are they going to know? You know, are they going to know?
Did you rehydrate?
Oh yeah, I mean,
how?
I was at 168.5 at weigh-in, so I actually lost like 7 pounds that morning or 7.5 pounds, and then And then I just, well, no IVs.
No?
You know? No, no, I didn't, oh. I don't, you know, I wasn't doing a scientific weight cut. You know,
but you're a smart guy.
Yeah, but I read up on it, but I didn't know how would I get a guy to give me an IV?
Oh my God,
how to
talk
do
to
it.
A fucking doctor. Jesus Christ. You went through all this preparation and didn't prepare enough to find a doctor? Yeah, an IV drip is just water. There's nothing unethical about it.
Yeah.
Well, they do it when you're dehydrated.
I mean, that does not appear to be the culture of the MMA world that I was moving in.
What do you mean?
I don't know that guys were getting IVs.
Well, they're crazy if they're not.
There wasn't
if you're
that
cutting weight, you should get an IV.
I still put every pound of those 6 pounds back on by the time the fight came.
You know, the issue's not putting the water back on. It's getting the water into your brain.
Yeah.
That's the real issue. Yeah. All of the more significant deaths, brain damage, all the big issues in boxing, almost all of them, except for a few isolated events, which were horrible beatings, which is why I think Eric Perez was involved in one. Is it Eric Perez? The heavyweight guy was involved in some horrible beating of this Russian guy.
Yeah.
And that guy suffered some pretty significant brain damage, which is a heavyweight bout, which is very rare.
It's usually little guys.
It's usually the people that cut weight.
Yeah.
It's usually the people that cut weight. The Duck Koo Kims. And I mean, that's one of the fights where they made the weigh-in the day before the fight. They changed it. After that fight, they also changed it from 15 rounds to 12 rounds because, you know, people were realizing like, hey, man, like this is fucking dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Losing all this weight, you dehydrate your actual brain. You make yourself more susceptible to brain trauma and bleeding. Gerald McClellan's another one. Was a notoriously huge guy, would cut a tremendous amount of weight to get down. I think he was fighting at 175. Was he 175 or 168? I forget what he fought at, but Gerald cut a tremendous amount of weight, got down, fought Nigel Benn, and had like he was bleeding inside the octagon, like, or inside the ring rather. He had an episode where he like had a stroke inside the ring, like in the middle of his fight. He had to take a knee and then just quit and realize something was way wrong. And people were like, I can't believe he quit. And then he collapsed in his corner, and you know, the rest is history. He's all fucked up now. And if you went back to the day, if you ever watched that guy fight, if you ever see Gerald McClellan fight, like back in the day?
I don't believe so.
Well, he was a terrifying fighter. And the big showdown was always going to be him and Roy Jones Jr. That's what everybody was thinking. Like one day, him and Roy Jones Jr. are going to throw down. Gerald McClellan was a fucking killer. He was a killer. But he fought Nigel Benn, and Nigel Benn was just tough as shit. And they went to war, and Gerald had him all but knocked out, had him knocked out of the ring. Like, he went through the ring, got back into the ring, got back, but just Nigel Benn would not quit. And there was a period in the fight somewhere where they collided heads, and that was one of the big ones. I mean, Nigel definitely landed some big punches on him, but they collided heads, and you could tell, like, after the headbutt, like, he was all fucking woozy and whacked out, and then, you know, he had to take a knee, and then it was over. And he's blind now. Think he can't hear, he can't move, he's all fucked up, and it's all just from brain bleeding.
Wow.
So it's a real issue, the dehydration issue. It's a real issue, not
Yeah, and you said, you know, earlier on, you said, you know, how do you stop it? And I think it is one of those things that's really, really hard to stop because, you know, as you've talked about on the show, any kind of new measure you set up, there's a way to beat it. There's a way. There's still going to be cutting weight. I think amateur wrestling has dealt with this. Little kits by body fat percentage things, or maybe hydration measurements. Like, you can measure how much hydration they have, so you can tell when the kid is cutting weight through dehydration.
Right.
I'm not sure if that would be possible to measure hydration levels. That might be one way to deal with it, but. But I agree with you. That one's a hard one to fix. That's why I keep going back to the gloves. I'm obsessed with the gloves things right now.
Well, you're obsessed with them for a good reason.
So why? I mean, if you agree on this after all your study, after all these years, and I agree on it, why do you think it's not happening?
Because it's incredibly hard to change once these commissions have these rules and regulations in place. They're very difficult to change. Once they're established, they're insanely difficult to change.
Do you think the UFC would be against it or for it?
The UFC probably would be against it in the current state. I mean, even if they listened to me, they rationalize like, well, you got some good points, and then there would be a but, blah, 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 we can't because blah, blah, blah.
What would the blah, blah, blah be?
Well, first of all, people would think it's barbaric.
So the
public perception,
yeah,
public perception, more cuts, which is probably true.
Yeah.
Probably a lot more cuts from Knuckles. You know, Knuckles.
More hand injuries at first, at least.
Much more hand injuries.
Until they
shorter,
figure out.
Shorter careers.
Yeah.
You would shorten your careers. I mean, there's certain guys that have had like significant hand injuries. One of the reasons why, when you see Vitor Belfort throw all these kicks recently,
is his hands.
His hands have been broken seven fucking times.
Yeah.
He's had seven injuries.
Yeah.
Seven surgeries, rather.
I think I think the major obstacle to it, if you thought it all through, the major obstacle to it would be, the upside of this is it would be a lot less neurological damage. The downside to it would be there'd be a lot less neurological damage.
Mm.
There'd be a lot fewer knockouts. There'd be a lot less heavy, you know, the barrages of heavy punches. And they'd have to change their repertoire of punches. They have to go back towards a bare knuckle style of punching.
Mm-hmm.
Much more straight punches, trying to throw punches into the fleshy part of the face that you're throwing with more control. Many more punches to the padded torso.
Using these two knuckles as well, using the front two knuckles.
You know,
traditional.
I actually read a bare knuckle boxing book. And, you know, they go back to the techniques of how it was done back then. And they're not giving that the two-knuckle thing is what I always learned, too. That's what boxers teach, what martial artists teach. They're saying, and it makes some sense, they're saying this is the surface.
Mm-hmm.
You turn it that way. So you have more surface area. So you're not putting so much damage here. And you say, and I've heard, you know, people say, you know, you're in alignment there, but you're kind of also in alignment there. It's not so bad either.
Mm. Well, the real
issue. And
they
throw them like this, too.
Right. The bare knuckle boxing, what you're saying is they would throw it perpendicularly instead of parallel with the ground.
Yeah. Throw a perpendicular punch into a boxing, into a heavy bag, and see what it feels like.
You don't get as much power,
though.
You get
not nearly as much power.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's designed to be that way. Because if you throw
it. To preserve the hand.
Because your fist will just explode on contact.
Yeah. Some people wouldn't have any problem with it. Some people with, like, big, giant hands. Like Brock Lesnar hands or Shane Carwin hands, those guys probably wouldn't have nearly as much problem. But if you can go back to the old UFCs and you see when guys fought bare knuckle, you very rarely saw like blistering combinations like you'll see like a guy like Vitor throw, you know, barrages of punches. You very rarely see those because you just kind of can't. You kind of can't do those without breaking your hand.
And they did break their hands.
A lot.
So, you know, I start off that article I wrote with a retrospective on, remember this fight, one of the greatest fights in the UFC, Hackney versus Yarborough?
Sure. He bitch slapped him.
You know, so Yarborough is like a 600-pound sumo wrestler who's 6'8".
Hackney's probably 215, maybe.
He weighed 200.
No, 200,
six
was
foot
it?
200 karate guy. And this was the early Wild West days of the UFC where they're like, what'll happen? We don't know. Let's see what happens. What happens when a normal sized man fights a giant? And you know, long story short, Hackney hits him in the head 41 straight times. I counted with his right hand. And at some point, you know, he gets Yarborough turtled up on the ground. And he's hitting him from the back, and he's hooking him from behind. He's coming in the back of the skull. You could do that back then. He's raising his hand up high like a blackjack, and he's like hammer fisting on one side, and then hammer fisting it on the other. And he just screwed up his hand terribly.
Yeah.
So you know, he walks. You know, Yarborough walks out of the ring. He's fine. He tapped out verbally, but he walked out of the ring looking no worse for wear. Those punches weren't all that effective. Hackney goes out of the ring looking at his fist, and it's swelling up, and it's bleeding, and that was the end for him. He didn't get to go to the next round because he had broken his hand. And so, you know, it's this great illustration of what would have happened if Hackney had a glove on. He would have beaten him to sleep.
Maybe.
Probably.
Big head. Yarborough's a big dude.
This is Hackney is a strong guy.
Yeah,
and he threw 41 punches at his brain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Yarborough was putting up no defense. He weighed 600 pounds. He couldn't get up.
Yeah,
he was stuck there on the ground. He's just laying there and just getting punched in the head over and over and over again.
Yeah, he's probably in the worst shape of any guy who ever fought in the UFC.
Yeah.
Maybe Aki Bono who fought Hoist Gracie.
And in retrospect, it looked incredibly barbaric because you're like, that guy should never have been in that cage. But people didn't know back then.
Well, he was a giant sumo champion.
He was giant. He was somewhat athletic. You know, he did some kind of athletic things in that match.
Moved.
Yeah, he moved.
Step
no,
left,
but he did
step
like
right.
He did. Well, that was enough. Yeah,
it was 600 pounds.
Oh yeah, he's chasing like a giant. He's got his arms out. It's like Frankenstein chasing him down. But you know, he literally threw Hackney through the cage. Mm-hmm. You know, he threw him out of the cage and down the stairs. You know, broke the gate.
Well, what Hackney did was hit him with an open palm, and I think
that was the first knockdown.
I think if he stuck with that, he probably wouldn't have broken his hand, which is kind of amazing. But for whatever reason, you can hit things really hard like that with the palm of your hand.
Well, it's partly because you can't hit very hard that way.
Well, you can hit,
if it's the same thing. Like if you're not turning it over.
Well, have you ever watched Boss Rutten fight in Pancrase?
That's true. Yeah.
Boss Rutten figured out how to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the first guy that really figured out. Pancrase was an organization.
Heel.
Yeah. Pancrase was an organization, for folks who don't know, in Japan. And they didn't allow gloves. And they also didn't allow punches to the face. You could kick a guy to the face, but you were wearing wrestling shoes. And then on top of those wrestling shoes, you had these big fat shin and instep pad. So there's this big padded up shin thing, and then you had nothing on your hands, so the guys would kind of slap at each other and try to kick each other. And
that was the rule, too, right? Yeah. You couldn't throw closed hand, I believe.
You could not throw closed hands, but you could throw closed hands to the body. But Boss Rutten, who's a Dutch kickboxer and had this fucking power explosion style, he was the first guy that figured out if you just pull your hand way back, you throw that bitch just like a punch. Mm-hmm. He would uppercut guys and hook guys, and he would beat, like when he fought Funaki, he beat the fucking shit out of him. And he beat him like a guy who was throwing punches. I mean, he would come at you with his hands pulled back like that, and instead of doing what everybody else is doing, which is kind of throw these wild bitch slaps, Boss Rutten was throwing them straight down the pipe, and somehow or another, he had stretched his hand out where he could pull his hand way back.
Yeah.
So he was just palming your fucking nose into your brain.
Yeah.
He was nasty. He was the first guy to figure out, like, you could there's a different approach you could take to this.
Yeah.
He was also one of the first real strikers. Like, you got to see the difference when he kicked guys, he did that fucking whack, you know, feel it in their arms.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like one of the beautiful things about watching the UFC since 93 all the way up to 2015, where we are today, is the evolution of the understanding of the techniques, of what's effective in certain positions, the distances, and those guys like Boss Rutten were critical for establishing that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, those real pioneers, there's fucking nobody before him and Pancrase that were fighting like that. There's nobody.
Mm-hmm.
He came along with big power in his kicks and ridiculous punching power and figured out how to do it with the palm, you know, and then you see him fight in the UFC when he can use punches before his body started failing him. Like, he's had significant neck injuries and to the point where he has significant atrophy of one of his arms. One of his arms he calls baby arm.
Oh, really?
It's like, he's had it fixed and had some stem cell stuff done and some operations and has discs fused in his neck and stuff.
There's a cost to this, man. There's
there is.
Yeah.
But my point is, you watch him fight against Tioki Kosaka, TK, in the UFC when he won the heavyweight title.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was throwing fucking brutal combinations.
Yeah.
And his neck was so fucked up before that fight, he couldn't even wrestle.
Huh.
He fought most of that fight, or trained most of that fight just kickboxing because his neck was so fucked up.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Don't I remember him wearing red boots in Pancrase?
Probably. Wore a bunch of different boots, you know. I bet.
But you could kick with the boots on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Wow. You had these wrestling shoes on with these shin instep guards over the top of the wrestling shoes.
I thought he had, like big patent leather red boots.
No.
I must be misremembering.
They were wrestling shoes.
Oh, they were?
Yeah, they were wrestling shoes. All Pancrase had like an outfit that they would make you wear. You would wear like those little skivvies.
Yeah.
You know, you weren't wearing like those MMA shorts that guys wear today.
Yeah.
Everybody wore like those little
Speedos.
Yeah, little grape smugglers.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a like an important time historically to watch those fights, to see the difference between the way they fought then and the way they fight now.
Yeah.
It's there's still room to grow, but the problem is you have athletic commissions, you have bureaucracy, and you also have, look, I love the UFC. I love working for the UFC. It's been an honor to work for them all these years, but you're going to have a certain amount of stagnation when you have one group and one organization that's so dominant over the other ones. I disagree that it's a monopoly, because Viacom owns Bellator, and Viacom has untold fucking billions of dollars. They have an entire channel that they can promote it on. I mean, Spike TV has an entire Friday night lineup that's dedicated to combat sports, to boxing, glory kickboxing. I mean, there's plenty of eyes on Spike. And they're also getting guys from the UFC now. Like, they have Phil Davis just signed with them.
Well, yeah. It's sort of the senior league for the UFC.
And there's also, they picked up this wrestler, this guy who helped Chris Weidman prepare for one of his recent fights. They're starting to get like these big time names, guys that are coming up, and a lot of that is also because of the Reebok deal. The UFC has a Reebok deal that doesn't allow them to get their own sponsors. They have to use the Reebok sponsorship, so some guys are shying away from it because of that. So like, the concept of a monopoly, I just don't think it's fair. I don't agree that it's a monopoly. I think they're better than the rest of them. There's better competition. They're better organized. I think the production is better. The people that direct it and produce it are better. Yeah. They're just the best at what they do because they've been doing it a long time.
Yeah.
But in having that like that, there's a certain amount of stagnation, because if someone came along and had a bare-knuckle UFC-style mixed martial arts event where they fought not in a cage but in a basketball sized mat. You know, like if you have arena for basketball, you have this big gigantic space that you have a wooden floor, this parquet floor on. How about do something like that?
That'd
with mats and have mixed martial arts? And when they go out of bounds, you bring them right back to the center again, and you have them duking it out again.
I like that. Yeah, because the fence is interesting, but it
hurts visually. You can't see that good. Me, I can't see that good. Yeah. I have the best fucking seat in the house for the UFC. I'm touching the floor that they're fighting on.
Yeah, I see.
Literally,
I
touching
see
the floor.
Yeah. I see you looking at the monitor all the time, too.
Yeah, sometimes I have to.
Yeah.
Sometimes when fighters are like to the left or to the right and the backs, like they're like up against the cage, I have to look at the monitor. Otherwise, I don't know what's going on.
I don't know if you ever looked at the crowd. Mm-hmm. We're all looking at the monitor, too.
A lot of times.
I mean, it's amazing to me. People pay for these good seats and everybody's looking up at the screen because it just shows better up there.
Less so with boxing. If you watch boxing, people are looking at the ring most of the time.
Is it because of the ropes? Aren't in the way so much?
Exactly. Yeah. And in that sense, Pride had the better idea when it came to that. But it was too hard, too easy to go flying through the ropes. You know, they had a bunch of Japanese dudes outside that were like ready to press, keep you from going out. They had guys like would
knocking your hand off the ropes. And,
there was that. Yeah. There was that. It was also like... who the fuck was Paulo Filho? I think someone used the ropes once to catch a guy in an armbar. Like, you had the guy, like, they were trapped inside the ropes. The guy's arm was trapped in the rope while he was getting armbarred. And I was realizing, like, whoa, like, he just used the rope to get that submission. Like, this is kind of fucked. Like, the rope came into play. It's almost like when Tank Abbott submitted Steve Jenham, he had his knee to his head and he grabbed the fence and he was holding onto the fence and pulling and smashing him in the face.
Yeah.
You know? That using the cage back then, like, you can't grab the cage just like you can't grab the ropes in Pride.
Yeah.
But it did come into play too often.
Well, and it comes into play still too much. It would be interesting. I'd like that because there's so much of the action now is pushed up against the fence.
I think if a guy grabs a fence, immediate one-point deduction. Immediate. Yeah. Immediate one-point.
The problem is it's so reflexive.
It
most
doesn't
guys
matter.
Most guys don't mean to do it. So it's like, you know, it's like.
But some guys do.
Yeah.
Some guys fucking grab that bitch. They grab it. They should know. You should know.
That's true.
I mean, you got to know. Yeah. You got to fucking know. And there's a big difference between a guy grabbing the fence when you're trying to take him down and then being able to stand up and then kicks you in the head, and a guy not grabbing the fence and you take him down and you dominate him for the rest of the round.
And they seem like they're never penalized on it.
No.
They'll get four warnings.
They should get an immediate one-point deduction. Same thing for obvious eye pokes. An immediate one-point deduction. And Dana has said this. Dana White has said this. That might be the only way to stop eye pokes, to give them an immediate one-point deduction. I think that might work. Yeah. I think there's got to be a way to cover the tips of the fingers. I mean, I don't necessarily think that these Bruce Lee style gloves were invented in Enter the Dragon are the only way to do it.
Yeah. Well, we have them at our gym. You know, some guys wear those, though. The Bruce Lee style gloves.
Yeah, those are cool. But what I'm saying is something to cover the tips of the fingers.
Yeah.
Because as a jiu-jitsu guy, like if I had like, say like, you know those Everlast bag gloves?
Yeah.
You know those style that come over the tips? Like those aren't really going to impede my grappling that much.
No.
Because I don't do this. and I don't do this. You know, you're never supposed to. You never, what I'm saying, I'm showing something to, obviously, to people who are listening, but interlacing your fingers. Yeah. You don't interlace your fingers. You grab in like an S grip or you grab in a gable grip. True. And these grips that you do, most of the really strong grips, don't ever involve your fingers sliding into the grooves of each other, of the opposing fingers.
Huh.
But I feel like something like that maybe could work where the tips of the fingers were covered up and it wouldn't affect you as much if you eye poke somebody.
Yeah.
But we're kind of like going into a dark territory here. having this experience, and I wanted to get back to your peers because we I don't think we really completely, we kind of got off track with that.
Yeah.
Having these people stand outside and watch you do this, was there, the reaction vary, or was it pretty uniform, or was there extremes on both ends where people were like, what the fuck are you doing? And other people were like, I want to be like you.
I don't know if anybody was saying, I want to be like you. I doubt that. But I don't know what was said behind my back. You know, you hear what Gottschall's doing. Jesus, you know, can you believe this? What a monster. But for the most part, people were cool about it. You know, it's, you know, to
but
my
they
face,
knew you.
They knew me.
Right.
They knew me, and they knew, you know, and I made light of it. You know, to me, it was always, I always, you know, played it off in a sort of a humorous way, as a, you know, basically me being fed to lions.
Right.
So, but again, the bigger problem is in the wider profession where people don't know me.
Right.
And that, you know, when those sort of people get a hold of the book, I hope they read it, you know, because the book is... it's not really even about mixed martial arts. You know, it's about using mixed martial arts as this bridge into big questions about human behavior, especially human male behavior, and the nature of masculinity and all the dumb stuff we get up to. And it's one of the reasons, you know, I thought of you as I was writing the book, actually. You know, a lot of people write a book and they don't have anybody in mind for it. They have like a vague, nebulous sense of who the readers are going to be. That never works for me. I always have to think of an actual person. You know, who's going to read this book? Like, who would be the ideal reader for me? And for me, it was you. And I thought of you a lot when I was reading this book. As a person, like, who would be interested in the subject matter, charitable and generous about it, because you know, these are things that you wonder about, too. And also sort of meshes with not only your interest in fighting, but your whole interest in human behavior. And especially your basically evolutionary outlook on human life and human behavior. And that's what the book is really about. It's sort of an evolutionary exploration of the basis of masculinity and manhood.
That's a very interesting way of approaching it, because I think that's one of the issues that people have when it comes to the idea of mixed martial arts or the idea of any sort of combat sport, is that in embracing that and supporting it or in even just pursuing it, somehow or another, we're doing a disservice to the idea of a cultural evolution that we kind of all agree is going on. If you compare society and human beings and our behavior today with what we know about several thousands of years ago, we know that we're in a far safer time, far more civil time, for the most part, in most places of the world. Obviously, there's exceptions. But
yeah, overwhelmingly.
But the people that are communicating now, we're communicating about, we have an understanding about what we would call, you know, what the super progressives like to call toxic masculinity, man. You know, which, and part of me, part of me understands where they're coming from. And part of me also thinks that where they're coming, that they're kind of copping out. And they're denying, denying certain aspects of their own life and their own masculinity that maybe they feel are weak.
Yeah.
And maybe they feel like they can't compete in these areas and they feel intimidated, so they want to demean them. And I don't think that's right either. You know, like there's some...
Well, masculinity is complex, you know, and it is, there are things about it.
So is femininity, but, right? I mean,
yeah,
so is being a human.
Yeah, being a human is a complex sort of thing. And there is something, you know, there is a case to be made that masculinity run amok is the great problem of history.
Oh, no doubt, yeah.
That men's tendencies towards aggression, towards kind of silly forms of competition, towards physical forms of violence, you know, that's what's been the big problem all along. And even though the world has gotten a lot safer, it still may finish us off in the end.
Well, that's the ultimate fear, right? The ultimate fear is that one dick-waving contest will lead to nuclear war, and then we'll all be fucking...
It's so plausible.
Knocking rocks together to start fires.
So plausible.
Especially look at some parts of the world that are like, they're fucking way closer than we are to Russia to killing... Like, you look at like what North Korea has threatened to do to South Korea, or what Pakistan and India, when they look at each other, and you motherfucker, I got a missile with your name on it.
Yeah.
All it takes is the wrong guy with the right amount of power, and that can happen. And it's very likely that we're saying guy for a reason.
Yes.
It's not going to be the wrong woman.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And yeah, there is a certain, there's certain reality to that. But there's also certain reality to the fact that the reason why we have these thoughts and ideas and we have this quote-unquote toxic masculinity in the first place is because it served our genes well.
Yeah,
that's why we
totally.
Got to 2015. Yeah. That's why we fought off the competition. And unfortunately, I think there's a yin and a yang to life. There's a give and a take, and there's an action and a reaction when it comes to aggression and when it comes to fear and danger. And that reaction is innovation, reinforcing the safer aspects of society, law enforcement. There's all these different reactions to violence that lead to a better world.
Yeah, and that's really what the focus of my book is. You know, I expected to write a book with MMA as a metaphor for this darkness, this blackness, this danger, this nastiness at the core of human nature. That's what I expected. I wrote a very different book than that. The book ended up being a book about something that I call the monkey dance. If you've ever seen like a nature video of two elephant seals clashing in the surf or two mountain goats cracking skulls on a hillside, biologists call those sorts of contests, they call it ritual combat. And ritual combat is a way that a huge diversity of animal species have developed to figure out who's bigger, who's tougher, who's stronger, who's fitter, without fighting it out to the bitter, bloody end.
Like chimps grab sticks and they pull them out of the ground, they beat the shit out of trees with them more
exactly.
than they fight.
Exactly, yeah. So chimps have, and that's a monkey dance.
Mm-hmm.
And humans are animals too. Most people seem to like to forget this, but we're animals too. We're complex animals, we're cultured animals, we're animals still. And the monkey dance is my name for human versions of ritual combat. And it's a broad diversity of things that mainly men get up to. Things like deadly duels and verbal duels, play fights among boys, and especially sports. And so a lot of these behaviors, the key thing is that a lot of these behaviors seem silly, they seem stupid, they seem pathetic. They're often volatile, and they're in danger of escalating to something truly dangerous. But on the whole, these monkey dances are a good thing. They're a way that men can work out their problems, thrash out their status hierarchies in ways that fall short of all out sorts of violence. So the chimps are a great example of this. You know, and humans do exactly the same thing. If you're at a bar and you knock shoulders with somebody and somebody spills their beer, it's likely to go down like this. There'll be some sort of insult, some sort of challenge. Someone will feel disrespected, dishonored. They'll bluster back and forth, just like those chimps in the jungle. But at some point, one of the guys is like, hey, I don't want to do this. And you'll say sorry, or you'll walk away. And if you don't, it continues to escalate. The guys will close the distance, they'll push, they'll punch, they'll tackle, they'll gouge.
Right, well, we're talking about a totally different sort of situation than competition. When you're talking about bars, you're talking about social things. You're talking about carving. I mean, honestly, no one knows. You know, when you bump into a guy in a bar, you don't know who the fuck you're dealing with. You don't know anything about it. You know, you just, it's a matter of a lot of chest puffing and a lot of posturing.
And that's usually enough.
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah. But what my take on it is that there's a big difference between that and what guys are doing to establish greatness. What they're doing to, when you achieve greatness in martial arts, what you're essentially doing by becoming a champion is you're showing a genetic superiority, you're showing a mental superiority, a character superiority that makes you more preferred for breeding. I mean, that's just the reality situation. Like, I joke around about it, but it's kind of true. The only reason why anybody gets laid is because Luke Rockhold didn't get there first.
I thought that was the greatest line, and it's completely true.
It's true.
It's so true. My wife would have little Rockhold babies if she could.
Nobody wants to admit that, yeah. You know, because nobody wants to admit that, no, man, my wife is not into that, man.
It's not just the way he looks. It's that he is that guy.
We have an organic vegan garden together, yeah. And we're amazingly connected. Your wife wants to fuck Luke Rockhold. Just deal with it.
No, I think that's right. I mean, when it comes right down to it, you walk around in the world and you see these differences between men and women. And you see physical differences, you see behavioral differences, and you naturally ask, where does all this stuff come from? And part of it comes from culture. There's no doubt about it. But a lot of it is biology.
It's total biology. Yeah. Women aren't showing up at hospitals trying to fuck dudes right before they die. They're not trying to pull their dicks out while they're coughing out blood. There's something about you. You're so vulnerable. I need you inside me. That's not what they do. They're attracted by power and strength and character. And not just strength as far as like the ability to oppress other people. Like, we traditionally look at those things, or it's in vogue to look at those masculine characteristics as being negative.
Like, oh, yeah.
That you're oppressing others, or the toxic masculinity handle.
No. But she's choosing a good hunter, a good provider,
but
and
also
a, and
someone
a good protector.
Who can deal when the shit goes down. Yeah. Some dudes, they'll chirp all around about toxic masculinity or negative male behavior, but the reality is they don't have any fucking character. And if something happens really bad in their life, they start weeping and they fall apart. That's unattractive. Yeah. And the reason it's unattractive to your friends, if you have a friend and every time something goes wrong in his life, he starts crying and he wants a hug, you're like, Jesus, bitch, get your fucking shit together.
Yeah.
Come on, dude. And that's how you're supposed to feel. Because you know that that guy, if anything goes wrong, that guy's not going to be reliable.
He's not a good ally.
He's not good to have in the tribe.
Yeah.
And these are unfortunate but realistic aspects of being a human being in the 21st century.
Yeah.
It's still there.
Yeah.
It's still there. I mean, one day we might come to some point where we have so much control over the world that we live in that masculinity won't be unnecessary. And if that's the case, we'll probably evolve to the point where we look like the aliens that are depicted, in every movie with the giant head.
No muscles.
Yeah. And the giant head that uses telekinesis to move things.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably where we're headed.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, the world has gotten softer and softer and safer, and we're still carrying this baggage, this evolutionary baggage of a sort of masculinity that's best suited to a world where, there's barbarians at the gates and bears in the woods and all that stuff.
But in this same world, there are avenues to express this masculinity where you can be completely civil, where
exactly.
you can be completely kind, you can be a generous person,
yes.
but get over your own genetics in a way. Give yourself difficult tasks to do. And even what we were talking about earlier, fucking yoga can do that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be beating the shit out of each other in a cave in a cage to achieve this.
Yeah.
But the victory over your own self.
That's what it is. Yeah. That's what I didn't know going in. I figured those guys must like beating people up.
Some of them do, though.
I think some do.
Tank Abbott comes to mind.
Yeah, and I think at the UFC level, maybe there's more of those guys. But I'm doing this very small time amateur fighters in Western Pennsylvania and Ohio. 99% of them are amateurs. 99% of them have no hope of ever winning any fame or fortune. There is no fame or fortune to be won. So why are they doing it? They're doing it because they want a challenge in their life. They want a quest in their life, and they want to do battle with their own weakness and their own timidity and try to defeat it. They're not dreaming about hurting people.
That's the way to express it. Do battle with their own weakness. That's why we have disdain for people that pick on folks that they know that they can beat. If you see a guy and he's a bully and he's like a 250-pound guy and he wants to fight a 100-pound guy, why does he want to do that? He wants to do that because he's scared of a challenge, because he's a coward.
Yeah.
A 250-pound man would never want... I mean, the only time you would threaten a 100-pound man is if that 100-pound man was threatening a 100-pound woman or something, or another 100-pound man.
Yeah, yeah.
You're trying to step in and keep the peace.
Yeah.
But when you see a bully, like, it's one of the most disgusting characteristics, because we know ultimately it's cowardice.
Cowardice,
it appears as strength because they're flaunting their superiority, but it's really cowardice.
Yeah.
And that's... a thing.
Otherwise,
that
they pick on somebody their own size.
Yeah, I mean, there was a. Here's a perfect example. There was a fighter that fell out of a card because he got injured, and they offered this other fighter a replacement, and he said, "No, I don't want to fight that guy." But then he listed off a bunch of guys that he would fight that were like way below him.
You know.
I mean, and his idea was like, "Hey, I have to change opponents in 4 weeks. I don't want it to be difficult." Like. And everybody was like, "Bill," like the mixed martial arts, the underground forum, it was fucking awash with people angry.
Yeah,
and they're right. They are right. They are right.
Yeah.
You know, either you're willing to fight another top contender who's just as capable of beating you as you are of him, or we're wasting fucking time here.
Yeah.
And we don't want to watch that. You got to understand, like, what did you sign up to do? You signed up to be a fucking gladiator, okay? Yeah. You signed up to be the most noble of all martial arts combatants of all time. You're competing at the highest level we've ever achieved in martial arts. Today, make no mistake about it, the fighters of today are the highest skilled, the most competent martial artists that have ever existed.
Mm-hmm.
There's been some great judokas of the past.
Yeah.
There's been some great taekwondo competitors and great Muay Thai fighters. It's been great. But as far as like the overall combination in the form of a mixed martial artist, today, they're the best that they've ever been. No doubt about it.
By orders of magnitude.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a student of this. I mean, a lifelong student. I've been deeply involved in martial arts since I was 14 years old. So I've seen all the levels. I've seen the difference.
Yeah.
There's a difference between someone who is doing it to achieve greatness and a difference to someone who's like barely getting by and they're really physically talented and they train really hard, but they're fucking terrified of a real challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys exist and they exist even at a very high level
because
they come from really good camps. They're really well trained.
Yeah.
They have, you know, they have a bunch of success under their belt, but they're always terrified of the one guy who's going to expose them.
Yeah.
It's one of the most fascinating aspects about fighting.
It's also bad business to lose.
Yes.
You know, so boxers, you know, are notorious for padding their records and fighting tomato cans. And
well, there's some guys that fold under pressure. It's one of the most impressive things about John Jones is that John Jones has overcome adversity in his career in a very, very obvious, character-defining way. Like, a good example is the fight with Gustafson. If you talk to the people that are in John's camp, they'll tell you, like, he barely trained for that fight.
That too.
Barely trained for it. But gutted it out in those last rounds and saved his title. The Vitor Belfort fight is another perfect example. Vitor caught him in a fucking deep arm bar. His arm was totally hyperextended. 99% of the population on this planet plus would tap.
I'm tapping just thinking about
it. Yeah, I mean, it was fucked up. His elbow was fucked up for a long time after that, too, which is one of the reasons why he had to coach the Ultimate Fighter and wound up, you know, going through that because he really couldn't compete. It was jacked. His elbow was fucking jacked, but he wouldn't tap. He wouldn't tap, and he went on to win that fight, and he went on to win it by submission.
Yeah.
You know, he submitted a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in Vitor Belfort.
Yeah.
I just think that that quality is something that is almost impossible to teach. Like, you either have it or you don't, or maybe you can gain it.
Yeah.
If you didn't have it, maybe you can put up these boundaries in your mind where you won't quit anymore.
I'm sure there's some native element to it. You know, some people are born tough and born with that kind of character.
I don't know if it's born. I think it's developed over the course of the adversity you face in your life.
I think that's right. But, you know, and that was one of the big findings for me at the gym is like, you know, you go into the gym and it's like, what's a fighter? And for most people, I think most people think a fighter is like, I don't know, a person who's strong and fit and has developed this toolkit of, you know, all these sophisticated techniques and all that stuff. But you talk to fighters, they don't define a fighter that way. They define a fighter as, you know, a person who's really tough and who will fight. And who's game in a fight. And that was one thing that I found sort of interesting going in, because one of the things I wondered about was whether I'd be able to do it, just go in there and square off with people. I didn't think I was ever going to be good at it, but could I compete bravely? And I do think that you do build your character by doing it. You do get stronger and tougher and braver through the process of, you know, of training.
No, I think so too. I think there's no doubt about that. I think there's also, it's curious to me that there's a bunch of people that are fight fans that are, they and even fighters that don't respect people that don't put themselves at risk. Yeah. Like a Floyd Mayweather is a perfect example.
No, I don't get that at all.
I don't get it at all either. I look at Floyd Mayweather and I see a genius.
Yeah.
I see a guy who's obviously troubled in his personal life and his treatment of women is atrocious and all the above. I mean, he's got all these arrests for domestic violence. I mean, where there's smoke, there's fire, right?
Oh,
spent time
he's
in jail
guy.
For that.
Yeah.
Got to be, or he's hanging out with chicks that everyone and anyone would smack. That's a possibility too, that nobody wants taken into consideration. I mean, you're hanging around with that dude. I mean, why are you hanging around with that dude? I mean, you know, were you attracted to him?
Well, he's rich.
Yeah, is that what it is?
Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows what the variables are? But what's undeniable. Like, I don't know him. I don't want to judge his character. What's undeniable about what you can view is inside the ring, he's a fucking genius.
Yeah.
He's brilliant. The way he gets guys to dance to his tune, he slows punchers down. He slows volume punchers down dramatically. He gets them to second guess what they're doing. He gets them off their game. He lights them up. He tags them. He clinches them. He just fights brilliantly.
The whole point of fighting is to do damage without getting damaged.
He doesn't do that much damage. That's where people get crazy.
Yeah.
He does a little bit of damage, but more than anybody else.
He scores.
Yeah. But in doing so, he's beat the fucking game.
Yeah.
I mean, he's 48 and 0, and he's never been knocked down. He's never been stopped. He's never been really hurt. Has he been knocked down? Maybe he's been knocked down. He might have been knocked down like early in his career.
Well, I think people were reacting there not to the lack of, you know, carnage. I think they reacted to the lack of drama.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are attracted to fighting sports, I think, for a lot of reasons. You know, there's probably a creature in us that kind of likes violence. But there's also this sort of drama to a fight that's hard. I mean, with that fight, you have these two guys. You have the good guy. You have the face. You have the heel squaring off in this incredibly climactic showdown that's going to define the story of their entire careers. And you're expecting some sort of epic battle to go down that's going to be incredibly gripping drama. And then, as a sort of dramatic spectacle, I think it sort of fell flat. Which is why that's my sort of theory for why the reaction to the fight was so negative.
Yeah, I guess, man. I mean, just when you're dealing with two of the best boxers of any generation, who I think Manny Pacquiao, I think it's safe to say that
95% of them don't know anything about boxing.
That is a problem, boxing fans.
Yeah,
that's what Roger Mayweather always says famously. It's a quote. Most people don't know shit about boxing. You ever seen him say that?
No, but it's true.
It's meme.
True. Yeah.
Anytime there's anything like on the underground, every time people talk about boxing.
But you're able to appreciate as an aficionado.
Yes.
And somebody who's really sophisticated in your knowledge of the sport, whereas most people are just wanting to see an intense drama.
Well, I watched it with my wife, who has never been in a fight in her life and doesn't know jack shit about fighting, which is kind of funny, you know, because, you know, if you look at our DVR, it's like two all competing philosophies.
Yeah, okay, right. Reality shows versus...
No, she doesn't watch reality shows, but she's, you know, she's very much into different shit than I'm into. And I don't mind that. I don't, and she doesn't mind, but it's like when our interests cross, when she watches what I watch, it becomes hilarious because she doesn't know anything about fighting.
Right.
She actually said this to me. I've said this a bunch of times in the podcast. I promise the last time I say it to anybody who's listening. She actually says, you should have to get knocked down in order to win. And I go, what are you talking about? She goes, well, that will make him fight more. I'm like, he's fighting. Do you know? God damn, woman.
Yeah.
Like, you don't understand what's happening here. This guy is, he's doing what he wants to do. If he stood in front of Manny Pacquiao and they just went rock 'em, sock 'em, robots, fucking anything can happen.
Yeah.
But the way he's doing it, he's controlling all the variables. He's controlling it, but he's controlling it with his skill and his dedication, and his practice and his knowledge, and he's information chunking.
Yeah.
That's something that I really truly appreciate about high level jiu-jitsu artists, about high level martial artists in any venue. I love watching people problem solve in real time much better than anybody else is doing.
Yeah.
And that's what he does. Like he knows how you're going to react to things. Pop. and he'll like pop you with that jab, and he knows that you're going to look to step to your left, and he's already out of there.
He's already gone.
He's already moved. Like when Manny Pacquiao would step in and throw that right hook, and Floyd would dip to his left and duck and slide right off the ropes. It was genius. It's artistic. You know, he planned it perfectly. He knew that Pacquiao has a certain type of blitz style, and Floyd just wasn't there.
Do you still
for
enjoy
it.
Watching boxing, or do you find it kind of boring after watching MMA?
It's not as fun, but I still love it.
Yeah.
Like, I really love watching Canelo Alvarez fight, because his fights are fucking chaos. Gennady Golovkin, who fought this weekend, he's the best.
Yeah.
Golovkin's the best to watch, because you know someone's getting knocked the fuck out. Like, that guy just is a destroyer.
Yeah.
He just seeks and destroys, seeks and destroys, and just slowly chips away at the best of them to the point where they just can't take it anymore, and their body starts giving out.
Yeah.
He's amazing. You know, he's had 350-something fights when you count his amateur career.
Wow.
He's amazing.
That's amazing.
Yeah, never been knocked down, never been dropped, never been hurt, and he's knocked out everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, and you look at him, he looks like he's in a boy band. He's a little sweetie.
Yeah.
You look at his face, he's got a big smile.
Yeah.
Even the way he talks, I bring big drama fight.
It's amazing. It's always amazing
big drama
in any sport where one person is so much better than everyone else.
Roger Federer
in tennis, or
Not necessarily that he is so much better than everyone else. He's so much better than everyone he's fought. He has to fight a Mayweather, or Mayweather's a little smaller than him.
Yeah.
His father, the way his Floyd Senior said it, he ain't fighting no damn giant.
I know,
he's not a giant. He's, he's fucking my size. He's 5'8" or something, or 5'9". He's not a big guy. You know, he's just amazing, you know, but he's 160. He fights at 160, and Mayweather is a 147.
Yeah,
so I kind of get it. But Canelo Alvarez, I think, is big enough to fight him. I think that would be a fucking fantastic fight.
Yeah.
God, Alvarez and Gennady Golovkin would be fucking amazing.
Because
Alvarez, I mean, he can knock out anybody, anybody, and so can Golovkin. I think Golovkin's a bit more skilled than him, a bit more refined and more technical. But goddamn, Alvarez is a fucking monster. He's a monster. That would be exciting. You know, Sergey Kovalev is another really exciting guy. These Russian dudes are not regular white people.
I heard you say
they
that.
They just are not.
So true.
We need to get that in our head, folks.
Yeah.
You look at these guys.
Eastern Europeans, you know, just coming from hard Scrabble backgrounds.
Ooh. And how about a fucking 1,000 years of hard Scrabble genetics?
That's right.
Yeah. And not these pussy Americans that we're dealing with.
Yeah. Bellator has a bunch of tough Russians.
Fuck yeah, they do.
Who's that?
Yeah, Shlemenko.
Who's that little guy? The Fedor, not Fedor, what do they call him? The Lord Frodo. You ever seen him fight? Frodo?
Oh, yeah. What the fuck is his name?
He's a little savage.
Well, there's a bunch of really high-level Russian guys that are in the UFC now, too, like Khabib Nurmagomedov.
Yeah.
There's another AKA guy.
Sad, man.
But, you know, I watched a video of him wrestling Luke Rockhold.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how come a fucking guy who fights at 155 is fighting the biggest 185, is wrestling the biggest 185 pounder the world has ever known? Like, what is going on there? Does he wrestle Kane too? I mean, how? Because I know that Rockhold wrestles Kane.
Yeah.
I mean, where do you guys end this?
Yeah.
Does he spar with DC? I mean, he's 155. What the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
So he blew out his knee again.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's supposed to be fighting Cowboy in my fight of the year. I fucking love that fight.
Love that fight.
Ooh. Yeah. But that's a stylistic fight. I mean, you got the best grappler, I think, in the division in Khabib versus one of the very best strikers in all of the UFC.
Yeah.
I mean, Donald is such a good Muay Thai striker. He's so good. He's so good at set. I mean, when you see him fight a guy that is not at his level, that's when you really understand how good he is. When you see him fight like a Jim Miller and see what he could do to those guys, that's when you kind of get in your head, you're like, whoa, this guy's on, he's on a very high level
right now.
He's
something,
It's also super confident, super prepared. He's been fighting so often, and he's like just in the groove right now. This is his time.
Yeah.
I like
some guys are kind
weekend.
Of bulletproof. I mean, he fights so much and he fights so hard. And
it's tough as shit, man.
He just holds up.
He, you know, he's just tough as shit. That's just like who he is. He's the real deal. I mean, that guy in his spare time, he rides bulls. Gets on fucking bulls and rides them. He jumps.
That's the most dangerous sport in the world, by the way.
That's not a sport. That's just people being assholes. You can't call that a sport. This is ridiculous.
Oh, there's a great article in the New Yorker about bull riding. It's amazing.
It'd be a sport if the bull signed up for it. If the bulls were like, yeah, man, I want to see if I can fucking shake a dude.
They breed these bulls, though. They breed them to shake. They breed them to be violent. They breed them to be dangerous.
Of course they do.
And they and it's the highest rate of head injuries, neck injuries.
Oh, we had a guy on Fear Factor.
Injuries.
that had his elbow or shoulder rather just destroyed. He was a professional bull rider, yeah. And he showed me his scars. Like, he took off his shirt, and his whole like his he had like lines everywhere connecting his shoulder to his
like a
chest.
Jigsaw puzzle. Or
so
something.
I said, like, how many times you had surgery? And he had some fucking ungodly number of shoulder surgery. I don't even remember, yeah. Like 9 or 10. Yeah. And he goes, anything goes wrong, it just pops out. Like, if he falls wrong, it just pops out, and then he needs someone to, like, yank on it. Yeah, I guess you got to extend it, and it'll pop back,
yeah,
in place. I'm like,
yeah,
fuck,
I have a friend,
dude,
who has that. Yeah.
Yeah. And all for what? So he can get that 8 seconds on a monster?
Well, it's the same thing with MMA. You know, it seems crazy to people from the outside, but there's a certain challenge to it. There's a quest to it.
I would hop in a ring. I would agree to 3 fights in a night before I would agree to ride a bull. No doubt about it.
Well,
no,
you're good at fighting. You're not very good at riding bulls.
Well, I don't think anybody's good at it. If the best guy could do 8 seconds, yeah, you fucking do. Everybody sucks, yeah, at riding bulls. If there was a dude out there that was like the Michael Jordan of bull riding, yeah, they could just ride bulls for like half an hour. Yeah. They're just kicking them, yeah, and shit. And he's like, what? You know, he's like blowing kisses to his mom in the crowd. Then I would say there's a guy that's good at bull riding. Yeah. But everybody sucks. Yeah. It's just some guys
suck. I'm pretty
suck
good at it.
Less.
I'm pretty good at it.
Good at bull riding?
Yeah, I was at this fair one time, and they had one of those mechanical bulls, and everybody's riding it, you know, doing it right the one-handed way. I'm like, fuck it. I'm gonna beat this thing. And I just clench it. I get on, two hands, hold on to it, bury my face into it, and just hold on, you know.
How was that?
Hold on. I rode for like 2 minutes.
Whoa.
Drove the crowd wild. Half the people booed me, you know, for cheating, and the other half were like,
I never thought
that. That guy's a genius.
So you grab it like a rear naked choke.
You grab it, yeah, like you're pulling guard as hard as you possibly can.
But wait a minute. Okay, let me think.
You see a mechanical bull.
Right, but where are you grabbing it?
You can just kind of grab around. It's
can
like
you pull a picture of a mechanical bull up, please?
A pommel horse in gymnastics. You know the pommel horse in gymnastics?
Mm-hmm,
it's
sure
kind of like that.
Right.
You can just kind of get under it with both your hands. You put your face into it.
I'm very curious now, because I rode one of those things for some stupid MTV thing, and I was, yeah, shocked at how easy it was for them to fly me off of that fucker. I didn't even last 5 seconds.
I rode for like 2 minutes.
That's insane.
It
okay,
really
let me look at
crowd,
that. Oh, there's a bunch of different kinds, huh?
Yeah.
Some of them actually look like bulls.
Oh, yeah, I rode real cow. I rode the cow kind.
The one that looks like a cow?
Yeah.
Did it have horns or no?
I don't think he had horns. Maybe he had rubber horns, but I could get right around his head. And
you
kinda,
don't
yeah,
want,
I,
imagine someone, yeah, died because it had real horns. That would suck. Okay, so you could get
that
your
that was
arms
the one right there. You see that one with the fair where, mm-hmm, they have the bubble around it? You know the
that right there?
Yeah, that one there.
Okay, click,
yeah,
on that.
That's the one I rode.
Okay.
You can just get him around the neck. You kind of choke him out.
Huh.
And you clinch real hard. Like, his head was bigger, so I don't know if you could get around his head.
Yeah, that guy's riding it like a moron.
Yeah.
Well, that's like why they call the rear naked choke the lion killer. They say there's only one way to kill a lion. You got to choke it.
Got to choke it out, yeah.
You got to get its back.
Hard to
which
get
is
its back, I think.
Good luck getting your fucking arms around a lion's neck. It's hard, yeah, to get your arms around a big guy's neck.
Oh, I know, yeah.
You know, get your arms,
yeah,
right
there. Yeah, there's guys that I can't choke.
Yeah, I mean, you could, but it's not easy.
Yeah.
But a lion is strong as fuck. They weigh 500 pounds. And a bull? So, okay, so you reach under, and what are you grabbing with your arms?
Well, again, his neck is too big, but just imagine his neck was a little smaller. You just get your arms around his neck.
Do you S-grip it?
I think I did. I did something like that, probably.
So,
yeah,
it was a small mechanical bull. You might have rode a bitch-ass bull.
No, he was killing everybody.
You were riding a mechanical cow, son.
Don't
like
say
a
that
calf,
don't
maybe
say
a
that
veal.
This was one of my best moments. I don't have many moments of victory.
So people booed you?
Half of them booed me for cheating, you know, because it was obviously like counter to the spirit of
dummies
the activity.
He broke the code. He figured,
yeah,
it out.
Yeah.
Good
but it was,
for you,
it was,
dude.
It was a little tough, though. I mean, my face was all like burned.
Cut up?
Yeah.
Did you get anything
up
out of it or just pride?
I got pride. I got a lot of pride out of it. I'm telling you about it on the air. This is my big moment.
Yeah, the idea of riding a giant animal. First of all, I don't like the idea of raising those things to do that.
Yeah.
I don't even like zoos, man. I go to zoos and it drives me nuts.
Well, it's not bullfighting. I don't know if it's
bullfighting's
such a bad
more fucked up.
Yeah, bullfighting's way more fucked up because I don't think there's anything bad that really happens to the bull. He doesn't like those people on his back,
right?
And he bucks them off ferociously, and they're only on there for 8 seconds. And some of these bulls are smart, and they figure out how to hurt people. Like, they know if they buck in just a certain way while throwing their head back at the same time, you know, they can really do damage to people and get these people off their back.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, some of them are basically killers, and they have to be retired because they get too good at it. Yeah. It's an article in the New Yorker, man. I'm not telling you. Google it. New Yorker and bullfighting. It's an amazing article.
Bullfighting.
Bull riding. Yeah.
Bullfighting, I'm hugely opposed to.
Yeah, yeah.
That drives me crazy. I just, first of all, there's a bunch of people sticking that thing with poison arrows or poison darts.
I don't know if it's poisoned.
Oh, don't they have poison in them?
No, I don't think it's poisoned. I mean,
really?
It's barbaric, but there's one of the great books about combat sport is Hemingway's Death in the Afternoon. If you haven't read that, I'd really recommend it, because almost everything he says about bullfighting is relevant, you know, to other forms of combat sport. You know, it's really a great book.
I always thought they had some sort of poison they use in those spears and they jab it into them.
I don't believe so. The spears are basically what they do. They drain energy from the animal, and they also force it to put its head down. Mm. And that's important because the killing stroke needs to be delivered over the horns. And so what they want is a very clean, balletic type of kill, which means that they have to get the animal's head arranged in a downward position so they can get the sword to go home.
So where are they trying to drive it into? It's like a spinal column?
Like I've seen them do it before. No, I think they're going for the heart, but they go in behind.
They go through the back.
They go in with a, you know, 2 foot, 3 foot sword all the way to the hilt.
Ooh.
Yeah, they go in right to the hilt. It goes in like butter.
Jesus Christ. Do they eat the bull after they do that? Because bulls are not that delicious, right?
I have no idea. I have no idea. I imagine they do. You know, these are peasant societies that, you know, developed this custom, and I'm sure they ate the bull.
Well, most people aren't aware that if you buy steak in a market, you're getting an animal that's been neutered.
Yeah.
You get what's called a steer, and they take a bull, and they cut his balls off when he's young, and they let him grow to size, and then they kill him. Yeah. So he has a more tender meat.
Right.
He's if you eat, yeah. like, I shot a moose in this guy right here in British Columbia.
That's him?
Yeah. This mother.
What, did you boil his face?
Yeah, well, I had a guy do it. I didn't do it myself. I'm busy, dude. I got shit to do. But yeah, it's called a European mount.
Like, that's amazing, the structure of the inside of his nose.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, their nostrils.
That's his nostrils there?
Yeah, their nostrils are incredible.
That's amazing.
And that's a deer. It's a little different. They're both deer. That's the largest deer in North America.
So how much was your moose? That's a moose? Because that doesn't look like a moose antler.
It's a small moose. That's why. He was only a couple years old, so he was only 900 pounds.
Wow.
But a big moose.
900 pounds is huge.
It is, but not for a moose.
How big did they get?
My friend shot one that was 1,400 pounds.
Wow.
But my point being that the muscle, like the tissue, is really dense. Like there's some areas like the back, like the tenderloins and the back straps that are more of a tender meat.
Right,
deep.
Right.
But the tissue of a moose is muscle.
Yeah.
It's just fucking unbelievably powerful animal that. I mean, if he got older, he would have these huge fucking saloon doors growing out of his head, and then he would use those to slam into other dudes who also have those things, and they're just so strong.
They're
so like, the meat is like really tough.
Yeah, they haven't been bred for eons to be hamburgers.
Exactly. Yeah. And my friend shot a water buffalo in Australia, and he said they cooked the backstrap, which is like the most tender part. And he said he had a piece of meat in his mouth that he chewed for half an hour. He's not joking.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, he said he was
wow.
practicing with his bow and arrow, and he was practicing for a half an hour with one piece of meat in his mouth that he was trying to break down. I mean, we're such pussies.
Yeah, we are.
We're so soft and mushy. We're talking about like cage fighting. And, like,
oh, I know.
Amazing. Yeah. Get in there. You're fighting against a person.
Oh, I know. I felt embarrassed about it a lot of times, about how scared I was when I would think about like how much harder, you know, other people have it. You know, I was reading other memoirs of people like who did dangerous things, especially like war reporters.
Oof.
Like Sebastian Younger went over and wrote books about the Afghanistan war. He went into this little platoon way off in the middle of nowhere. I mean, they're really in the shit.
Mm.
He got blown up in a Humvee, you know, all kinds of, you know, badass stuff. And he didn't complain. He didn't bitch and moan about it.
He went back.
He went back. I know.
That guy's nuts.
The bravery of those guys is astonishing. And so you compare the cage fighters. These guys seem really brave, and they are. But that's a whole other level.
Well, and Sebastian Younger is not even shooting back.
No.
He's writing.
Yeah.
And
he's got his head up because he's got his camera. Because he's videotaping all this stuff. He did two documentaries, and you know bolts are flying, and he's got his head up.
What kind of fucking PTSD does that guy have?
Well, his friend died. You know, like a week after, or not a week after, but soon afterwards, his friend, the other cameraman, a guy named Tim Hetherington, was killed, I believe, in Libya. And so, yeah, I think he's got some pretty severe emotional. Psychological damage from it. He said he was not going back. He said he's not going back to war zones anymore.
Yeah, I would say that's a good decision.
Yeah, yeah. He knows when to quit. Yeah.
But if it wasn't for guys like that or the people that filmed like Restrepo or...
Yeah, he's that's who it is.
Yeah.
That's who it is. That was Hetherington and Sebastian Younger.
Yeah. And there's a new documentary that...
Younger's a fighter, you know, by the way.
Was he?
Yeah. Sebastian Younger, read my book, please.
Looks like it. His nose is kind of jacked.
Yeah, he boxes.
Still?
I believe so, yeah. I believe so. He's a tough guy.
That's one of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about. When I had heard this concept, the professor in the cage, the protecting of essential cognitive function, which is necessary to pursue your career.
Yeah.
I mean... Did you find there was any negative repercussions physically?
The first time I got punched really hard in the face was really it's really educational, you know, because watching from outside the cage, you kind of know, like, you know, this isn't good for these people. You kind of know it's a brain damage contest, but it's different to actually feel it. And the first time I got knocked around pretty good, and afterwards kind of felt concussed, even during the attack, even when I was taking these shots, I was able to think to myself, you know, I make my living trying to think smart thoughts, and I better quit while I still know my alphabet. But I didn't.
But what was the negative aspects of it?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think I had a lot of headaches, and occasionally I would be cloudy, you know, for a day or two afterwards. You know, there's a sort
after sparring.
Yeah, I'd be like a little. I felt like it was, like, you know, I described it as sort of like a translucent blanket thrown over my head, and it slowed my thinking and clouded my perception.
Did you ever get that same sort of feeling just from hard training where you're exhausted?
No, this was definitely a time where a couple of times I got, you know, again, it's one of these situations you're in sparring and guys hit you too hard, and there was a couple guys who were notorious for it, and I got really jacked up by a few guys. One time where, you know, this guy just landed this brutal left hook against me, and he didn't really mean to. Like, he apologized afterwards. I was moving in, you know, he tagged me hard, and, you know, I was almost knocked out. You know, saw stars, the whole world, my perception of the world sort of starts flipping over, the lights are kind of going on and off, and but I didn't, you know, with brain damage, it's usually a, you know, a time bomb that goes off sometime in the future. So you don't know.
There is and there isn't.
Yeah.
There's also, there's an accumulative damage issue, but there's also, I've met guys where I knew them and then they had one really hard fight and then they were different.
Yeah. So I didn't have anything like that, at least not to my knowledge. I mean, I'd have short term repercussions of it. But
how often were you sparring?
Our gym was not all that enlightened of a place, you know, and the culture of it was pretty intense. So I don't know, probably twice a week, pretty hard sparring, you know.
I'm always fascinated by people who know the repercussions and still dive into it and still just say, you know what, it's worth the risk.
That's what everybody's doing. Nowadays, everybody knows the risks. I mean, MMA fighters, you know, these are smart guys. These are middle class guys. Most of them are college educated.
But a guy like you is different because you're not really, I mean, you are an MMA fighter in that you did fight, but that's not like what your pursuit.
Yeah, it is my pursuit though. My pursuit is writing books.
Right.
And I saw a good book in it. So I did it for professional reasons too. I mean, there was a personal reason. I'd never been in a fight before. I was kind of curious about whether I was a coward or not. And I wanted to do this brave thing. For me, it was a brave thing. But there was also a professional thing, just like the fighters have. You know, the fighters are doing it because they need to make a living. I was doing it because I wasn't making much of a living, and I needed to try to do something
mix it up.
That would
shock
a little bit, shock me out of my old ruts, and write a book that had a larger audience than the books I'd written before, which are sort of books for English lit nerds.
Now, what was the actual experience of the fight like? Talk us through the day of it. What did you feel like when you woke up in the morning and you knew, holy shit, today's the day?
I was, you know, there was a level of anxiety that was always there. I was glad, however, that I didn't feel the terror that I felt that I might fear. I was afraid that I'd be so scared that I'd, like, chicken out or just behave in a cowardly fashion. And there was a lot of anxiety, but it wasn't as bad as I expected. And when I got in the cage, one of the things that was really interesting to me, because I didn't know this would happen, is all of the fear pretty much evaporated. Fear is really, really useful. You know, it's your body's way of saying to you, dude, this is really dumb. This is really dumb. Let's reconsider. Right. Let's see if there's a different way to do this thing. So it's useful going in, but once you're in the cage and you've been locked inside, fear is no longer very useful. Cowering is not going to save you. You know, you're locked in. There's no getting out of this thing. And my fear just kind of went away. And it was replaced by something that was really cool in retrospect. It was this sense of focus that I'd never felt before. Never felt before. Nothing close to it. Like, I was in this arena, a minor league hockey arena. There's people there hooting and howling. I saw nothing. I heard nothing. All I could see was the guy in front of me. All I could hear was him. You know, I had this incredible tunnel vision. So at some point, my coach was screaming at me, you know, screaming out instructions, screaming out warnings. And he's a loud guy. You know, he's one of these classic corner men whose voice just fills the whole arena. I never heard it. I never heard it. There was just nothing in the world except for that guy.
How'd the fight go?
I don't want to give too much away about it, but...
Why is that? Is it in the book?
It's in the book, and I sort of build some suspense to it, but, you know...
So you don't want to tell us what happened?
I'll tell you a little bit about what happened. The fight was 47 seconds long.
Did you win?
I won the first 46 seconds. And then the fight took a nasty turn in the last second.
1 second?
Pretty much, yeah. It was pretty abrupt. For 46 seconds, I was sort of imposing my will, and things were going my way, and I was starting to feel good. And then things went bad. Yeah, things went really bad, and it was over. It was that fast. It was amazing.
Did you want to do it again after it was over?
Desperately.
Really?
Desperately. And it wasn't even sweaty yet. I wasn't even sweaty yet. And I was like, okay, now I know how to do this.
Did you get hit or did you get choked?
I got armbarred.
Oh, that's not a bad way to lose.
No. It wasn't, but it wasn't. Part of it, you know, I'm approaching it as a writer, and I wanted like a story that was more epic, you know, more of a, I don't know, just more of a heroic struggle, something that would make a better story. And part of it was, you know, I really screwed up. I really screwed up in the fight. And afterwards, I was like, okay, now I have this under my belt. I was almost positive that I wouldn't have made that mistake again. I would know how to do it. I kind of made a really bad rookie mistake.
What was the mistake?
Well, basically, my strategy going in was I was always a better grappler than I was a striker. It wasn't that I was a great grappler, but I was better at it than striking. And so we didn't know anything about the other guy. We knew nothing. He had no Google presence. We didn't know if he was a striker, a grappler. We didn't know if he was left-handed or right-handed. These are all really bad things not to know. And so the game plan was just we'd take him down and try to make him fight me off his back because that's what I did best. Right off the bat, you know, within, you know, a few seconds I shot, got the takedown, got him down against the fence, was about this close to securing the mount. You know, he kind of had me in a headlock. I got out of it. I swept my foot up and was almost in the mount. And then, you know, that then was the first clue that I was out of my league. You know, right away, he just did this really kind of fancy, sophisticated thing where he drew me effortlessly into the guard and started working on that armbar. And I knew something was bad. Something bad was happening. And so I got up and I yanked and yanked and yanked and yanked and got out and ran for it. Okay, he rolls to his feet and chases me. And at that point, that was when an experienced fighter would have said, okay, it's not a good idea to roll around with this guy on the ground. We need to change the plan. And that's what my coach is screaming at me. You know, he's screaming at me, you know, you don't want to go to the ground with this guy. And immediately, you know, I couldn't break out of the game plan. It never even occurred to me. So I waited. I sort of set that ambush. We were waiting for the guy to throw a punch, throw a kick, and you shoot. And that happened. You know, he kicked me in the ribs. And at the same second, I shot. And it was this great moment in my life. It was almost better than the bull riding moment. There's this great picture. I got him, you know, I had a perfect double leg takedown. You know, he's airborne. And we come down hard, smack. And at this point, I feel like I'm in control of this fight. I'm winning. Everything's going great. And the next thing I know, I mean, 1 second, 2 seconds later, he'd somehow swept me. It was a fancy armbar. You know, I was a white belt at best. And it was a fancy armbar where he managed to sort of flip me over like a pancake. And, you know, next thing I know, I'm looking up at the ceiling instead of looking down at him. And it was tight. And
did you watch it?
I watched it, yeah. But it took me a while to even figure out what he had done.
Is it available online?
No, I don't think so. I have the video I could show you.
But I'd like to see the transition.
Yeah, yeah.
what he did.
I could show you. Like, we could get on the ground here and I could show you.
Okay.
To you, I'm sure it would be really, really basic. Super basic. But, you know, for me, I'm only a year into this at this point. My jiu-jitsu was pretty rudimentary.
One of the things, and this is going to seem weird, that I've been noticing about yoga, is getting into yoga again recently, is the various complexities of each position.
Yeah.
It's not as simple as, like, put your leg here, stand up. It's like back has to be mm-hmm. straight. You mm-hmm. expand your chest, yeah, lengthen your back,
yeah.
push down with your heels, you know, push your hips forward. There's all these different variables that you have to take into consideration in every single posture. Well, the same exists in jiu-jitsu, just on a much more complex level. There's so much, because you're attacking someone, and then they're defending, and then yeah. you're anticipating the defense and setting up a second attack off of that defense. Oftentimes, the first attack is just to gauge how they respond, and then you know, and there's you chaining all the, like, Helson Gracie, Steve Maxwell's famous strength and conditioning coach, jiu-jitsu black belt, been on this podcast a few times, described how Helson Gracie describes jiu-jitsu, and he goes, because he's got, you know, kind of a pretty deep accent, he goes, you do this, then I do that, then I do this, then you do that, forever.
Yeah, that's good.
This
yeah.
is a great way to yeah. describe it.
It's, sure. Yeah.
And the more you understand about each position, the more you understand about yeah. where could things go wrong, where can things go right, what are you trying to achieve? And when you don't know that, like, you, the way you're describing it, you're like, yeah. what's happening?
I had no idea. How am I? Yeah, there was exactly. no this or that. It was like, he did this and it was over. And
well,
so what
is.
Happened was, like, why I wanted to fight again, like, right then afterwards, was because I knew that, you know, I had chosen exactly the wrong game plan to fight this guy. And afterwards, we became Facebook friends. And I see all of his pictures on his Facebook page are of him with gold medals on his chest from winning
jiu-jitsu,
you know,
competition.
Jiu-jitsu tournaments.
Yeah, so he's
so
a
I was
jiu-jitsu
completely
wizard.
Out of my league.
Is he a black belt?
I don't believe so.
Close.
But yeah, he's really there. Good. Yeah, he's really good.
Have you considered just really training hard at jiu-jitsu?
That's what I'd like to do, yeah.
And how old are you now?
If I can get healthy, I'm 42. Yeah.
Gets yeah. tough.
I know. Yeah.
It gets tough.
Well, the problem with me is, and, you know, this is why I think I had so many physical problems. It's like there is a nature and a nurture to flexibility. You know, some people have really high vertical leap just by nature. You know, mm-hmm. some people are really flexible just by nature. I appear to be the guy who's not very flexible by nature. And I work on it really hard, but boy, I just don't seem to get much more flexible.
I oppose that because no one in my family is flexible but me.
Yeah.
And the reason why I'm flexible is because my body developed by stretching. I mean,
I was stretching from the time
I was really young.
Yeah, well, that could be it. Starting when you're young and supple. I mean, but when I was in my early 20s, you know, if you're doing karate, there's a lot of stuff you just can't do
mm-hmm.
if you're not very flexible. And so I worked on it really hard.
Well, there was a guy that used to come to our jiu-jitsu gym. This is one of the reasons why I pose it. And he was this big fucking football player. And he was like 250 pounds. And whenever I used to roll with him, I used to literally say, I'm going to go ride the bull. Because that was what was like rolling with him. Like,
yeah.
he wasn't good.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
I was a brown belt, and I think he was a white belt at the time. And so I would always get him, but
yeah.
it would be a while.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be fucking, like, hanging on to this guy for
right.
a long time and riding the bull. But this guy was a dedicated athlete, and
yeah.
one of the things that he did was he radically improved his flexibility while he was there. When he first started out, you know how you sit there like with your legs in a butterfly position
mm-hmm.
and you try to push your knees down to the ground? He couldn't even come close. His knees are like stuck up like
that's
this.
That's how I am.
He
yeah.
couldn't push them
yeah.
down at all. But that fucking guy would be there after class for 40 minutes, longer than
yeah.
anybody else, just stretching
yeah.
just pushing his soft tissue to the limit every
yeah.
day.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of dedication that led to a year plus later, like my friend Eddie Bravo, my jiu-jitsu instructor as well,
yeah.
he always talks about that guy, this one guy. He fucking put in the time,
yeah.
put in the numbers, and he got really flexible.
Yeah.
I mean, he was almost at a full split after
yeah.
like a year and a half. But it was the kind of dedication that led him to be a football player.
Yeah.
I mean, he was a professional athlete. And this guy just fucking put on the blinders and went for flexibility. He knew he was ridiculously strong. He knew he was ridiculously powerful. So he had to learn the technique and he had to get flexible.
Yeah.
And so I saw him do it, man. I saw it take place. So whenever someone says,
yeah, but,
they
you
said,
know,
oh, you only have certain restrictions. There's only so
but
far
you say
you can
this
get.
All the time. You say that not everyone's given the same genetic gifts.
Yes.
It's unequal.
No doubt about that
about
when it comes
your,
to fast
your friend
twitch.
Eddie Bravo, you know, like, he's just a freakish, he has some freakish flexibility in some areas.
He does, but it's also, he's stretched those areas ad nauseum. I mean, that guy, you'll be watching TV with him and he's pulling his foot to his chest.
Yeah.
Like, seriously.
That's
everywhere.
Right, too, though. I watch TV and I stretch the whole time.
You know, I don't know how much
you
stretched.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know how much you stretched, but I do know that I watched this guy do it, and I watched this guy get way more flexible, and it was amazing. But my point is like, there are unquestionably physical gifts that you can't achieve, like fast twitch muscle fiber, speed, and power.
Cardio too.
Cain Velasquez is the one that they always bring up.
Yeah.
Size of bones, size of the hands, the width of the shoulders, all those things contribute to power and also like the explosion, like the fast guys, like a guy like Uriah Hall. Like Uriah Hall, without a doubt, is trained very hard and well prepared, and he has excellent technique. But you watch Uriah Hall shoot a straight right hand, and you're like, okay, like, I don't know how many guys can do it that fast.
Yeah.
Like he'll be like moving around, and all of a sudden, whap! He'll like lean in with this right hand. And you see the look on the guy's face after he got hit, where he realizes, like,
what just happened?
Whoa! Yeah. Like, this guy's got some next level speed. Like, I was talking to Uriah's coaches after one of his fights. He's like, he's the fastest fucking guy I've ever seen. Like, the fastest guy. Like, you see him in the gym. I mean, he is so fucking fast.
He's amazing.
Some of that is, I mean, some portion of that is unattainable for the average person.
Yeah.
That's just the reality.
Yeah.
But it does.
Why would you think it would be different for flexibility?
Because I think flexibility is something that you can push. Because it's just a matter of how far your soft tissue goes. No, not
cardio,
really.
You can push like crazy. And there's a
capacity,
limit.
Capacity, though, is different. The size of the heart is different. Like, that's one of the things they always said about Lance Armstrong. He has an enormous heart.
That's part of the training, too, though.
Could
you
be.
You grow the heart. It's a muscle. It atrophies. It hypertrophies.
Mm-hmm. Plus all the shit that he took.
Yeah. He's also injecting steroids directly into his fucking heart.
And one of those ones from Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, exactly.
When they revived Uma Thurman. Fucking right in there. Who knows, man? Who knows? I just think that flexibility is a little bit more simple. I don't think you could achieve the flexibility of, say, like...
You have an anecdote of your big friend. I'm saying that I think I'm the other anecdote.
Might be.
Yeah.
I've never seen you stretch, though.
We'll do it after.
Okay. We'll see how hard you push it.
Because
some people get to a certain point, like, okay. But you got to get to that super I can't breathe point.
Yeah.
And you got to push that bitch.
Yeah.
And it's just... It's also like, how do you do it? Do you do it correctly? Do you have someone who's pushing you correctly? And where are you starting out from? You're starting out from 39, 40 years of doing jack shit to stretch out, and then all of a sudden you're trying take these mature, older muscles and pull them apart.
That's a big part of it. That's right. So I've been sitting at a desk for years and years.
Yeah, I mean, if somebody got a hold of you when you were 16.
It's very possible.
And when you were doing Kyokushin, did your school really emphasize stretching?
I did, you know, because I knew... I knew I couldn't kick guys in the head, and I knew I wanted to be able to, you know, because that's a big part of it. There's all kinds of kicks, all kinds of cool stuff I couldn't do.
Right.
So I got a stretching machine, you know.
Chuck Norris jammies?
I don't know if it was Chuck Norris. I got a knockoff version because it was cheaper. No crank, no.
You didn't have a crank?
No, mine was different. It was like some kind of like PVC type.
Oh, okay,
thing.
I know that type. Yeah. It was like a pipe.
Kind of push your legs apart.
You pull the pipe and it stretches your legs apart.
Yeah, exactly.
Those do a little bit, but realistically, you don't need that. What you really need is just someone who can help you and push your back down, and then also the ability to withstand pain.
Yeah.
That's it. The uncomfortable feeling of pushing your muscles to the limit.
Yeah. I don't mind that.
It's hard to change your body in many ways. It's hard to develop more muscle because your body doesn't want to. Your body doesn't want to change. You know, your body just wants to get really sore and then discourage you from continuing to lift.
Right.
You know, like in order to force your body to gain weight, like if someone say to me, "Hey, man, I want to put on about 5 pounds of muscle," well, you're going to have to work out 3 days a week like a madman for a year.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Yeah.
You know, there's one thing if you're a dedicated professional athlete, you've been doing it a long time, and your body knows how to grow, and there's a certain amount of also muscle memory that comes into play. when you see someone who is really big, but then they lose the muscle mass, like maybe they'll get into something else and they'll stop lifting, they can get really big way quicker than the average person.
Yeah, that seems right.
It's a fact. Mm-hmm. Like, say if you used to weigh 230 pounds, you're a big fucking giant dude, and then you drop down to 170, you could gain, like, if you took two dudes that weighed 170, and they were both, you know, reasonably fit, and one of them used to be enormous, he will get bigger quicker. Just muscle memory.
Yeah.
There's no getting around that. But your body doesn't want to do it.
Mm-mm.
You have to really push that bitch. And I think the same takes place with flexibility, and the same holds true with gains, with size gains. This is very difficult to do.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to push your body to this really uncomfortable position, and then you have to fuel it with all sorts of food.
Yeah.
It's like I get a kick out of whenever people compare. Like, it's a funny thing. Like, it happens on my message board or my forum sometimes. Like, people start talking about diets and caloric requirements, and then they'll bring up, like, Michael Phelps. Well, Michael Phelps ate 15 fucking pizzas a day, and he did. Like, do you have any idea how hard Michael Phelps works out?
Yeah.
Don't ever fucking compare right. yourself to Michael Phelps. Yeah. Just stop. He's the greatest Olympic swimmer the world has ever known, and whatever genetic gifts he has, they were unquestionably accentuated by a barbaric work ethic and weed.
Yeah.
Those things helped.
Yeah.
I think that weed helped him recover.
And he's 6'7" or something.
Yeah, he's a big, giant, fucking long dude. Yeah. But also the amount of calories that guy was burning every day. The average person really can't relate. You can't relate.
No.
Like, the amount of effort that it takes to be a Chris Weidman, the kind of training camps that Vitor Belfort goes through, what John Jones went through when he trained for Daniel Cormier.
It'll be interesting with the stronger drug testing. See if these guys can get through these kind of camps.
You got a very good point.
Yeah.
Well, that's the dirty secret, you know, that's sort of being slowly but surely revealed. For the longest time, there are certain things that you couldn't test for, like growth hormone. Yeah. You couldn't even find it. You know, I had a conversation with Chael Sonnen after he got popped.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wanted to talk to me on the phone about, like, how he should approach it. And Chael's a funny guy, man.
Oh, he's great.
He's fucking hilarious. Amazing. He's a great shit talker, too. But he goes, yeah, you know those drug tests? Turns out they're really good. You know, he got caught for all sorts of shit that he never thought he could get caught for. Yeah. Growth hormone, EPO.
He had it all.
Yeah, he had a cocktail going. Yeah. But, you know, in his mind, I think he had a very small window to achieve something, and he probably was correct in assuming that he wasn't the only one doing it.
Yeah. He's probably correct in assuming that it's almost not almost impossible, but it's really hard to get to win the belt without it.
Well, Jose Aldo had a really interesting thing to say, and Andre Pedernales as well. They were talking about steroids, and they're like, well, we support testing, but I hope the UFC realizes the fights won't be as exciting.
Mm.
Like, the fighters won't be as good.
Well, they're also going to be out of fights more often. You know, they're also not going to be able to make it to fight day.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to have the healing. Benefits of all that testosterone.
Yeah, you're redlining your body, going through camp, and then bing, bing, bang, bang. Yeah. Things fucking break off and cylinders blow.
I don't think they can work as hard as they're working without some help.
Some can.
Some are clean.
Some have always been clean. Guys like Frankie Edgar.
A lot of guys who think are clean turn out not to be, you know?
That's a problem.
I mean, I think Frankie Edgar is almost certainly clean.
Mm-hmm.
But who knows if he's not eating EPO. And that's, you know, one of the secrets to his incredible cardio. I don't think that at all. But you wouldn't know is my point.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, John Fitch really surprised me when he turned positive.
Tons of people were surprising. Anderson Silva was surprising, right?
I wish I could tell you that Anderson. I'll tell you off the air.
Yeah.
I can't tell you on the air the Anderson Silva situation, but it's a bit more complicated.
Okay.
First of all, he unquestionably took some for his leg.
Yeah.
To try to heal his leg. 38 years old, you get a broken leg.
I can see the temptation, for sure. Yeah.
There's a lot. And there's also, I think that there is nothing, this is my opinion, I think that it is, not only is there nothing wrong, but there may be a case for doctors to prescribe some sort of steroids, some controlled amount of some sort of steroids for catastrophic injuries, like massive leg breaks or, you know, pec tears. Mm-hmm. Or there's some pretty fucking significant injuries. Here's another one. Hector Lombard went through a bulging disc, like a significantly injured disc, and then was fighting, you know, like I think he had a fight scheduled like 6 months later. Good luck trying to recover from something like that in 6 months. I mean, You kind of can, but can you recover enough in 3 months to go through a three-month camp?
Most likely
not. Yeah. And then he turned up positive for some designer steroid that most people didn't think they were testing for. Mm-hmm. You know, like the whole Barry Bonds thing with the clear and all this. You know, there was a lot of that going on, I think. In boxing, there was a lot of that going on.
There's tons of it. I mean, the big giveaway is we have all these old guys. These guys in their 40s still competing as cage fighters.
Well, that doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, it was Randy was like kind of the last one that competed at a super high level.
But still just be able to do it at all in that sport, man. Mm-hmm. In your 40s.
But Randy's also an undeniable freak of nature because Randy never got hurt. I mean, Randy lost and he got knocked out and stuff like that. But I mean, in training, like he never had a surgery, never had a broken hand. He got his arm broken in the Gonzaga fight, but that was blocking a kick.
He looked awfully good for 50.
It's a fucking stud. Yeah. He's a goddamn, I mean, that's the real Captain America. Yeah. Randy Couture is a fucking stud. You have to be able to, I remember.
But don't you assume that he was on something? In that era?
Yes and no. I don't have the evidence.
I mean, yeah, I don't want
to. I assume that it's very likely. Well, I've said the same thing about Fedor and people got mad at me. Fedor fought in a dirty league. Yeah. He fought in Pride. It was a dirty league. I mean, Ensign Inouye sat in the very seat you're sitting in and was laughing about his contract for Pride where they told him that we don't test for steroids. Does that mean that Fedor was not on it? No, it doesn't mean that. But when you have a league where everyone's on it, like Vanderlei was without a doubt. And I said, one of my favorite fighters of all time, if not my number one favorite.
Yeah.
Like, when I get excited to watch a fight, when Vanderlei was fighting, it was probably the most excited you can get. You know, just like, you knew it was just going to be chaos. Yeah, just such a berserker, you know?
Yeah, he was terrifying.
But he was obviously on some shit.
Yeah.
Obviously. Yeah. And the Vanderlei that showed up at the UFC was not the same guy. He just wasn't. Yeah. I mean, he still had that warrior's heart, but his body just did not cooperate the same way. And a lot of it is probably because his endocrine system is all fucked up from years of using stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, was he? I don't know. Who the fuck? I don't know. You know? Yeah. I'm just guessing. I'm just all guessing.
No, I'm totally guessing.
You know, the Vanderlei one, Vanderlei ran away from a drug test, too, and now is suspended indefinitely, which I think is kind of fucked up. You know, I think if they should have, the worst they could give you at the time if you tested positive was like a year. They should have given him a year.
Yeah.
They should have said, look, dude, we know what the fuck is going on. And then if that's the case, he'd already be fighting again by now.
Yeah. You could treat it just like that's a concession. I concede that I'm using. Yeah. If I run, I concede.
Yeah. They wanted to make an example out of him and they said, you know, we're going to give you a lifetime ban. Well, that's fucked up, man, because this guy, this is his life. This is his living. You essentially took away his living from one violation. The only violation of his entire professional career.
Yeah.
Well, you know, suspicions aside, I mean, there's certainly suspicions of when he was competing in Pride, and even possibly suspicions of when he was competing in the UFC. But the reality is, the guy never got caught except for the one time where he evaded a test. Treat it like it's a positive test. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, mm-hmm. I get the whole idea of sending a fucking message, but that message has long been sent. I mean, everybody knows. If you test positive, and then you see the new testing rules that they pulled out,
that's
new
intense.
Ones are brutal. Yeah. The new ones are
3 year?
3 year. Some of them are
for
lifetime.
First defense?
Lifetime if you have a second, if you try to run away from a test. A second time you try to run away from a test, it's a lifetime suspension.
But 3 years for a first offense.
I don't know if it's 3 years or it's 2 years. I think it's 2 years, 3 years for a second offense, something like that.
That's almost a career ender.
Not only that, they take 75% of your purse, up to 75% of your purse.
Yeah.
There's some big ones.
If you take 3 years out of a guy's prime.
Especially a guy in his late 30s,
or his
like
late
an
years.
Anderson.
Yeah.
Like Anderson. Anderson's going through, I don't know what they give him, a year and a half, and he's fighting against it. We'll talk in about 10 minutes, and I'll give you the whole rundown of what
cool.
I actually
all
know.
Right.
You go, oh, I wish I could tell you. Here it goes. First offense for testosterone, anabolic steroids, HGH, 36-month suspension, fine of 50 to 75%. Second offense, 4 fucking years.
Ugh.
75 to 100% of fighter's purse. Third offense, lifetime suspension, fine of 100%. Avoiding first offense, 4 years, fine of 75%. Second offense, lifetime suspension, fine of 100% of fighter's purse. Well,
I wonder if that'll be enough. I guess the idea is we're going to hang you they're trying to set up a sort of almost a zero tolerance policy in order to scare guys straight.
Well, Ronda Rousey had a very good point. And this point is that if someone uses some sort of anabolic steroid and they can hit their opponent more and then that opponent dies.
Totally.
Is that murder? Or is that manslaughter?
That's interesting.
Very good point.
And the guys are already superheroes.
Exactly.
And then you juice them up and yeah, that's dangerous.
You can most certainly, if you're on EPO and human growth hormone and testosterone, you can most certainly hit someone more than you would be able to if you were not on that.
Definitely.
Especially if like these cases where guys are testing with like literally superhuman levels. Like Vitor, when they eventually rescinded the testosterone replacement therapy thing for Nevada, when they tested him, he was at 1,475. An average man in his prime is like around 500 to like 800 for some crazy stud.
Yeah.
So he was like essentially like double a human being.
Wow.
The level of testosterone. Yeah. So it's crazy.
Yeah.
Nevada judge overturns Wanderlei Silva's lifetime ban. Really? Does this just happen today?
Yeah.
Holy shit, breaking news, ladies and gentlemen. Talk about fucking current. And talk about poignant. Wow, pull that down. Let's fucking scroll that. Good for him.
It broke at 2:30.
Wanderlei Silva won a major victory in court today with a Nevada district judge throwing out the lifetime ban. I will applaud. I applaud that. ESPN's Brett Okamoto reported via Twitter that the judge did agree that the Nevada State Athletic Commission had jurisdiction over Silva despite being an unlicensed athlete at the time, but that there was not sufficient evidence to support a lifetime ban. I agree. 35-12-1 MMA, 5-7 in the UFC, was handed a hefty punishment after he ran from a random drug test. So they overturned the suspension. The lifetime ban, but it doesn't mean that he's been reinstated.
Right.
It's not reinstated. But what's good, he's still under contract with the UFC. Like, the UFC wouldn't even let him. He said he made a bunch of, like, really critical videos about the UFC, which, again, a lot of these guys, man, they need someone to talk to. I would love to be the guy, you know? I'd love to be the guy that talked to a lot of these guys and just go, don't do that. Don't do that.
There's he was banned for life.
Well, also, he was talking about the UFC treating people like slaves. And then, you know, Dana's like, we gave you $9 million.
Wow.
That's how much he made in the UFC.
Did he really?
Yes.
Holy cow.
It's like, come on, son. That's not slavery.
That's not slavery.
You fought for 7 years. You made $9 million.
No, that's good money.
It's good money, man. Forever.
Yeah.
And you had seminars. You ran a gym.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You did well. You're a fucking, and he's a loved guy. I just have a soft spot in my heart for Wanderlei. Like, as a human being, like, when I know him, when I meet him and see him, I always like to see him. He's a very warm, friendly guy. And I just, any guy who's willing to fight like that guy, that guy fucking.
And be a sweet guy out of the cage. That's so fascinating about people like him. Like, I had some friends from my gym who trained with Wanderlei's gym. They all love him.
Oh, he's a sweet guy.
He's the nicest guy.
But he spars like it's life or death.
Yeah.
Like, there's videos of him sparring.
Yeah, I've heard about that.
And I'm like, Jesus.
Yeah, that was the real Stone Age. What was that, Shootbox?
Yeah, Shoot the Box.
Shoot the Box.
Well, Hujamar, you know, the guy who ran it, he.
What does Shoot a Box mean? Does it mean shoot and box? What does that mean?
That's a good question. Yeah. I mean, it's obviously a Portuguese version, probably, of Shoot Box, which is. That's how John Donaher describes MMA, like shoot boxing, you know, like shoot box rules, the rules of engagement and the way you approach it and think it. I think that what they did at Shoot Box was establish like the most aggressive, most intimidating team ever.
Yeah.
You know, especially at that time.
Yeah.
Like, they were just all berserkers.
Yeah.
Wanderlei, Shogun, Ninja, Anderson, Pele.
Mm.
There was just one killer after another.
In their primes, too.
In their primes. Yeah. And then, you know, Rafael Cordeiro, a guy who's gone from that gym and now is training like Fabricio Verdum, radically increased his striking. Rafael Dos Anjos radically increased his striking. So
those guys are good.
Yeah, it's not just like that attitude and that drive. It's also skill.
Yeah.
Like, those guys are very skillful.
Yeah.
And they just also know about, they know about putting pressure on motherfuckers.
Yeah.
Like Dos Anjos versus Pettis, that was just aggression and pressure.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
But again, after that fight, I've got Nick Kersa on, the guy who trained him in the strength and conditioning up. I think he's here next week. He's here on Wednesday. And I'm really interested to talk to him about it, because his style of training fighters, he learned from the Marinoviches, the same guy that got BJ Penn in the best shape of his life, back when he fought like Diego Sanchez. Mm-hmm. Like that BJ, I think, one of the greatest fighters of all time for sure, BJ Penn. But I think that BJ is the prime BJ.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm really curious to see what their approach was to get a guy in the kind of condition where he could fight five retarded hard rounds like that.
I don't know how it's possible. I don't know how it's possible. In the amateur divisions, we did 2 minute rounds. And if you were in a, you know, in really intense rounds where the striking was heavy and you mix in the grappling with it, all the heavy exertion of grappling, I was more, you talked about having a heart attack doing hot yoga. I felt that way all the time. Like, I'm going to die. And I watch these guys on TV doing 5 minute rounds after 5 minute rounds, and sometimes walking back to their corners after this crazy round with their mouths closed, breathing calmly through their noses. To me, that's the most freakish thing about these athletes.
Did you watch Neil Magny this weekend?
Well, I know. I actually listened to the Fight Companion.
Oh, dude. Yeah. It was Neil Magny's got insane fucking cardio. Yeah. It's insane.
Well, a lot of them do. You know, Benson Henderson. You know, Benson Henderson has these frenetic fights, tons of grappling, tons of striking. He's just never tired. They don't know what it's like to be tired of these
work
guys.
Work ethic. Just insane work ethic and never getting out of shape and never abusing your body and always eating the right foods, getting the right rest, putting altitude tents up in your house. Well, Neil actually trains at altitude. He trains
He's in Denver.
In altitude MMA, actually. That's his gym in Denver.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, there's an advantage in that for sure. There's an advantage in sleeping at altitude is the big one. They actually say that you should go up to Big Bear to sleep and come down to sea level to train. That's what they say.
Oh, yeah, I see that.
Because that way you could put out more output.
More workload. And,
more work,
but
you recover because of the sleeping at altitude.
Right.
We're almost out of time, but what's the biggest thing that you got out of this whole experiment, other than a great book? Which I've heard nothing but fantastic things about this book, by the way. It's one of the reasons why I wanted to get you in here. Heard that you're incredibly honest in this about your fears and the experience and very eloquent. So The Professor in the Cage, go get this book, you fucks. It's great. I can't wait to read it.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. I don't even read hardcover books anymore.
Well, like I said, you know, when I was writing it, I was thinking to myself, sometimes, if Joe Rogan doesn't like this book, I'm fucked. It means I totally whiffed.
I'm gonna Kindle it too. Yeah. I don't read. Kindles are so much better to me. I just love that little thing and you flip.
I like the paper.
Oh, you're one of those guys. What are you making your own firewood? What is the big thing that you got out of this?
Personally, or sort of intellectually?
All of the above. I mean, intellectually is personally, right?
Personally, I'd been through a sort of lifetime of, I was a late bloomer as a kid, real small, always sort of the runt of my, in school. I'm a sort of an average size guy now, but I came to my growth really late. And so I sort of have a basic, schoolboy story about getting pushed around and bullied. And there's no heroism in that story. I always backed down. I always ran for it. I always found some way out of it. It wasn't because I was a pacifist. It wasn't like I had some noble, high-minded reasons for avoiding the violence. It was that I was scared, and I knew I was going to get my ass kicked. But I've always kind of felt like that's no excuse for not for fighting, that there's you should stand up to the bully. I've always felt that way, and even though I never did it. So part of what I wanted to do was I wanted to go into that cage, and I wanted to sort of stand up to guys who were stronger than me and more skilled than me, and sort of taking those beatings that I felt like I should have taken 20 years ago. You know what I mean?
Wow.
And so
that's deep.
Well, yeah, this is, I don't know if you ever had experience like that as a boy, where you behaved in a fashion that you define as cowardly.
Yes, definitely.
And it's amazing to me. I'm 42 years old now. I've had a lot of accomplishments in my life. I have a beautiful wife. I have little children who are wonderful. It's amazing to me how much psychological weight that still carries for me, that I can still make myself blush. Wow. Thinking back to those moments. And so part of it was a redemption story for me about whether I could do something to redeem myself, at least in my own eyes, for those times when I'd flinched as a kid.
That's awesome. Yeah. I love that. I love that you did that. I don't love that you're still blushing over it.
It's silly. It's so stupid. It's so crazy.
But it just means you've got work to do. That's all it is. You just got work before you realize you're not that guy anymore.
Right. Right.
I sort of became what I was terrified of. That's to avoid being bullied. I just became someone who's, I never got in fights, like from high school on, I never got in fights, but I didn't get in fights by becoming far stronger than I ever was before.
Yeah.
But I still would think back, like guys that I was scared of when I was in high school, like, whoa. But it never, I never feel like I want to go back now and fucking kick their ass. Like that was surprising to me that I never wanted to do that.
Yeah.
And I never wanted to go back like, hey dude, you remember when you fucked with me? You know, I never wanted to do that. I also never carried that burden around.
Yeah. Yeah.
One time when I was, I think it was about like 19 or 20, when I was already a black belt and I was working out at my gym where I used to teach in Boston, and I was just doing these heavy rounds on the bag preparing for this tournament, and I looked up and this guy was watching that used to bully me in junior high school. This guy, not even from my high school, but from I went to this like really rough junior high school in Jamaica Plain, which is, it's kind of gentrified now, but at the time it was like a really sketchy area, Massachusetts. And I looked up and I felt bad for the guy. It was really interesting. Like instead of being angry at him, I felt bad for him.
No, that's right. I mean, all those guys from high school were just kids too. You know, they were fuck ups too. They had their own insecurities. They had their own problems. They're not bad people. It's stupid to be hung up on it. And I'm not very hung up on it. I don't have any fantasies of going back and beating those guys up. But I do hope they'll read the book and they'll think, "Boy, he was a cowardly boy, but he grew into a brave man."
The Professor in the Cage. You can buy it right now, and it's available on Amazon. Right, I can get a Kindle
you can get
a version
bookstore.
Of it.
Oh yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you, John. Really appreciate it.
Hey,
really appreciate
it.
This is fun.
Come on, I appreciate it, man.
Go buy it. Go read it, ladies and gentlemen. The Professor in the Cage. I'll be reading it. I'll be talking about it on a future podcast, I'm sure. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe.